workshops and with text practitioners, which you normally do after the hearing. But we hope you do have the hearing so that we can still continue with the workshop during June, July. And thereafter, there's a process to absorb what people have commented on, perhaps have one or two further meetings, smaller meetings with people, and then to come up with the revised bills, which are then formally tabled, and then you have your formal hearing. So that's just to remind ourselves on the process. Move on. So, Chair, I think if you just to remind ourselves broadly, of course, we can't run away from the fact that the reason why we have tax policy is to make sure that we raise sufficient revenue, firstly for the state to do all what it should be doing, and which was kind of obviously dealt with largely on the expenditure side of the budget. But also, I think that this time round, you know, we did make the point in the budget review that last year was one of the most challenging periods that we've had for revenue collection. And I remember last year when we did the presentation, it must have been just after June 30th, because after the first quarter, we just saw that we were down 8 billion rands. And unfortunately, we collected not just 8 times 4 quarters, 32 billion less, but it doesn't move linearly. We collected about 60 billion less last year than what we had initially budgeted. And obviously, that had quite an impact, I think, obviously on the size of our deficit and on the extent to which the state could fund programs. So I think that's still a challenge, that we're just coming out from one of the most severe economic recessions, certainly in many of our lives here. But in spite of that, we were able to deal with partial fiscal drag relief. In other words, adjusting the thresholds that we have, the brackets that we have for personal income tax. Yes, we know it wasn't to the full extent. And we made some changes in the monetary thresholds. I think we had said it was 6.5 billion rands. The budget is so far behind, one's got to remind ourselves of those. We all also have to deal with lots of measures to limit tax avoidance through salary structuring and to curtail certain aggressive financial transactions. One of the big themes in current budgets has been to take measures against the environment, and we revised the vehicle carbon emissions tax. As you know, last year we implemented the electricity levy. And I should say that with all the discussion on Eskom and the recession, we were under a lot of pressure not to go ahead, but I do think that we cannot be short-sighted. It was very important that we took the necessary steps to change behavior of all us human beings to make sure that it becomes more expensive for us to pollute and undermine the future of those who will be living beyond us. To move on. So the specific proposals, and we'll go through all of these that we dealt with, was just to remind ourselves. For individuals, there was the fiscal drag relief measures. There was adjustments to medical scheme and tax-free interest monetary thresholds. Some of these are normal every year. But we also narrowed some of the interest exemptions for individuals. We did some reforms to fringe benefit taxation of company cars. Reforms sounds like a nice word. We meant we tightened. We had some measures around key person insurance versus deferred compensation schemes. We merged a severance package measure that we had in our system with the previous reforms that we've had on withdrawals from your pension or retirement funds. We also tried to look at employer coverage of professional fees and indemnity fees to make it a tax-free fringe benefit. Many more anti-avoidance rules, which we'll come to. And, of course, quite a big announcement that we did announce our intention to phase out sight, and you will hear all about that as we go through these slides. With regard to business, there were also several changes, improvements on leased government land to allow for development of land in inner cities, interest allocation for finance operations, a whole lot of measures to enable Islamic financing, liquidating residential property companies. We had to also bring in some measures to coordinate with the company law changes, micro-business presumptive tax refinements. Go on. And then there were a whole lot of other measures, certainly with regard to international transactions, restricting the exemption for cross-border interest, transfer pricing alignment, promote the financial gateway, using South Africa as a gateway to Africa. And then there were some measures which we announced on offshore cell captives, which we haven't been able to put in this legislation. We need further work. It will be rolled over to 2011. And in fact, we issued a media statement last week, which is available on our website, and Keith can talk more about that if necessary. Special entities, we're trying to promote amateur sports by their professional sports bodies. Indirect taxes, back there were some changes, cancellation of intergroup loans. And I think on the admin side, some significant changes, and that's why we have the SARB here as well, in that we have a voluntary disclosure program to provide some relief for those who, for whatever reason, haven't fully disclosed, that they have an opportunity to come forward and disclose. And I should add, I know the minister mentioned this in his budget speech as well, that, you know, internationally, as we've closed down on tax havens, I should add that here's an opportunity for those who didn't come through on previous amnesties to come through and disclose, become honest, and the opportunity is not just on the tax side, and I should add, it's not an amnesty, it's just to make sure that some of the penalties and so on are waived, but France will go through this, and our colleagues from the SARB will just go through a similar approach being taken on some of the exchange control punitive measures when they find out that you have funds overseas that you didn't reveal. So I think that this is quite an important measure, and we would certainly hope that those who did not come forward before, that they will come forward and put their matters right. The world has become a tougher place. We do get to find out things. You would have seen in Liechtenstein and Luxembourg that all kinds of information on people's bank accounts came out. The German tax authorities used that information, Italy, etc., all kind of using that. So I think that we would hope that people would come forward. France can go through the rest of the issues later, but there's advanced tax ruling, persons who are exempt from provisional tax, recovery of employees' tax on fringe benefits from employers, including World Cup tickets, and T-shirts, compulsory electronic returns and payments for transfer duty ratification of administrative rules for customs modernization. But we'll go through those. I think that, as with all budgets and tax proposals, and we try and give you a comprehensive picture because we don't always have to do it through legislation, but some of the proposals include the usual increases in the general fuel levy, which was 10 cents in the general fuel levy, and in addition, 8 cents per litre for the road accident levy. These were effective from the first week of April. In addition, we imposed a 7.5 cents per litre charge for 3 years to fund a new pipeline between Durban and Gauteng. Increases, which has been done by Transnet. Increases in the usual SIN products. I think the minister did raise the issue. Are we hard enough? Should we not be harder on these issues, but we put in the usual increases. As I pointed out, there's the introduction of a carbon emissions tax, flat rate on new vehicles from the 1st of September. And there were some technical amendments to the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Royalty Act, which came into effect 1st of March. Again, we were under pressure not to this measure was postponed a few times. We were under pressure not to go ahead. And now you see the Aussies have just started imposing further taxes. So the world is going in a different way from those who asked for this to be postponed. So just in summary, these were the main tax proposals, just in terms of rands and cents. As we said, if you look at the adjustments to personal income tax, you'll see that that cost, we estimated, $6.5 billion. In total, we thought that we were foregoing $6.7 billion. There are some negatives like the $6.5, but also increases like from the fuel levy, the increase in excise duties, the CO2 tax. And all in all, you know, in net terms, we were foregoing $450 million and expecting, after the tax proposals, to collect $643.2 billion for this coming year. I think, and Cecil may come in, but just I think for us to get some perspective, because in spite of all these changes, the big taxes, obviously some of their rates may get changed, but this just gives you a sense of the trends, that, you know, the big picture there, if you look at the eighth row, the subtotal, or the ninth row, total tax revenue, you'll see that we collected almost 29 billion rand less in the financial year that ended on the 31st of March this year, that's 2009-2010, than we collected the previous year. Now, this is a huge shock to the system, because if you know, in 1998, we collected 185 billion rand. You know, 10 years later, we collected $572 billion. From 2007 to 2008, we collected almost 53 billion more. You can see from one year to the next. Yet the following year, we actually collected 26 billion less than we did the previous year. So, in other words, although normally your tax revenue base goes up, last year it actually fell. So we moved backwards. I don't have to tell you that our expenditure demands obviously didn't decline. They continued to increase, hence the bigger deficit that we had. Just to give you a perspective, if you look at the last row 13, you'll see that whereas in 1998 we collected tax to GDP of 24.4%, and how that increased to, at the height of the boom, 27.5%. You can see that from 2008 that declined, and, you know, with the recession, it reached in 2009 24.4%, almost exactly where we were in 1998. So you can see that there was a huge impact that we felt in terms of revenue. Move on. And just to give you a feel again for the specific taxes, I mean, if you look at the collection that, you know, as I said, they were less by 4.2%, and particularly customs duty was 13.6% below the previous year, and 26% below the year before that. Now, those are huge decreases, and certainly for many of the SACU countries, customs revenue is the big driver of the amounts that are allocated in terms of the formula. So this will have a significant impact on other SACU countries, on all SACU countries, because the pool actually got smaller, and because of the initial projections were on a larger amount, that's what they call a T+2 formula. It means 2 years later, their amounts will be severely reduced. So that just to give you a feel, that it's going to have a huge impact, and some of our neighboring countries might have anything up to 70% dependent on the funds that they get through the SACO agreement. In terms of corporate income tax, which has proved very volatile, we were 18.4% below 2008. That's what we collected last year. And even 3.8% below the previous year. So you can see the decline is quite significant. STC, okay, it's a small amount, but also big declines. And even VAT was 4% down on the previous year and 1.7% below the previous year. So you can see that our tax revenue has not grown. In fact, it's declined last year compared to the previous, not just the previous year, but the previous 2 years. So I think just to move on, coming back to what happened then last year was that we collected, if you look at that total tax revenue row, you'll see that it's 60.5 billion less. We collected 598 billion compared to the original budget of 659 billion. Of course, the amounts get revised down in adjustments budget. But I guess if you really want to see how successful SARS was, it depends what you compare against. If you compare against the initial budget of 659 billion, obviously there's no way SARS could have matched that, just given the recession. And I think we need to just keep that perspective. It's the economy that drives what largely SARS would also collect, but it was still more than at the time of this year's budget. We revised what we thought we would collect for this year, and we revised it down from 659 to 6590. Of course, we also revised in MTBPS. We revised it to 589. Then we reduced it further to 590, that revision was perhaps a bit lower than what it turned out, so hence SARS collected 8 billion rands more than what we said at the time of this year's budget, but 60 billion less than what we said in last year's budget. I know these figures get confusing, but hopefully made that clear. Again, if you look at the last row, if you look at the SACO number there, you'll see that what was available in the pot stayed static, because once you make the allocation in December every year for the coming year, that stays the same. Therefore, they would only take those hits in 2 years' time. That's how the formula works. Okay, just to move on. So perhaps just to go through the key amendments, and I'm going to ask Keith, Cecil, or France just to lead. I guess Cecil will go through this and show you the adjustments in the bracket.
Thanks, Mamo. Thanks, Chair. As Mamo mentioned, Chair, the major change in terms of tax relief we provided in this budget was in the form of partial fiscal drag relief. And there you see on the left side of that particular table is the 2009-10 income tax bracket running from 0 to 132, and it goes on. And what we've done basically is we've kept the rate unchanged but changed the brackets running from 0 to 140 and so on, also changing what is referred to as the primary rebate for people below 65, everybody below 65. And then for the secondary rebate for people 65 and above, that translates into a tax threshold or tax-free income threshold of 57,000 for people below 65 and 88,000 above 65. And that was the major PIT relief that we've given. In addition to that, the next slide. We have adjusted the monetary thresholds, and one important one is the medical contributions that we have now over the past 3 years fixed at a particular rate per beneficiary. We've increased it from 625 to 670 for the first two beneficiaries per month, and then from 380 to 410 for additional beneficiaries. We did announce that we will convert this deduction into a credit. That would be work that will be postponed for 1 year, so we will do some work and we hope to publish a discussion document on this later this year to see how we're going to effect this conversion. We also remind you that we have made some changes into the way we treat travel allowance. The deemed kilometer was abolished in the previous act or the previous budget. It became effective this year. And to try and reconcile that and align it with company car or employer-provided car, amendments is being made in this year's budget to affect that. And in the next slide, you'll see what we are proposing is that currently the law provides for the first car to be taxed at 1.5% as being deemed private, and the second car at 4%. What we will do is we will assume everything is private and it will be taxed at 4%. Also important is that the value on which we calculate that 4% will be amended. It will include that, and for now it will also include maintenance plan. And that's something that we have to debate, whether it's appropriate to include a maintenance plan. But for now we have decided to include that, and we'll have to see how the comments we get deals with. Assuming that people do use the car partially for business purposes, we have to make some amendment, and again to align it with the travel allowance. We're not going to tax you at the full 100% benefit, only at 80% benefit. So the effective monthly fringe benefit will be 3.2%. And we also acknowledge that in some instances, which is a bit weird, but people do get a company car and also have some expenses to maintain that car. So you find occasions where a company give you the car, but you have to pay for your private fuel, for example. And in order to accommodate that upon assessment, people will be able to claim that back based on actual expense and in the case of fuel, based on a fixed rate. And that just go on and explain what I've just said. Okay, thanks. Keith, you take it.
Thanks. Just a conceptual note. We've divided up the slides is according to the explanatory memorandum. Just to note, I know this stuff is all fun to you and you like looking at the tax law. Just to note that when you look at the law, you should have the following documents. You've got the law, which is there, a nice readable form for you. I'm sure MoMA's going to read that right now, right? And once we look at that, just to note, there's an explanatory memorandum that's quite in depth. We put the slides basically in the order of the explanatory memorandum, so that can get you in there. And then there's also a clause-by-clause reference, which gives you keys everything in. But just before
I come back, I think the explanatory memo is really something which you can read, like Keith says, clause-by-clause, goes into quite a lot of detail beyond what's just in the slides. And that's what you should read, aside from what's in the slides. If you try and read the legislation, unless you're a lawyer or... you know, you're going to reconcile with the income tax and the different acts. You're going to find it very, very difficult unless you're going to have lots of support behind that.
One reason why it's also very difficult to follow is this is an amendment act. So you have to pull out the original act with the amendment act. That's why the explanations are there. But then just to note the way we divided this out, there are basically four overall areas the way the EM is broken out. There's individual and savings. There is business tax, there's international tax, and indirect tax. We're going to focus on the individual issues first, then we'll move over to indirect tax, we'll move the slides around a little bit, then we'll deal with business and international. In discussing just conceptually, before we go into the detail of the individual ones, basically what we're trying to do in the individual area is we're trying to simplify. We're trying to simplify for both the benefit of the taxpayer and the benefit of SARS. And what you're really trying to do is make sure that when you look at the rules, they require less and less explanation. And that is taking some time. If you'll see a lot of the rules, a lot of them is based on historical anomalies, a lot of special interests and various things.
And what we're really looking to streamline the whole process. And as you streamline the process, it's been better for everybody. For example, if you want to file a return and you want to go onto e-filing, it is fairly simple to do that, and I'm not a technological guy, but I can actually do it. And it didn't take me very long. And if I can do it quickly, then I think all of you can handle it. So the point is we're trying to make sure that everything is done in such a way that it makes it easier and easier. And what you see here on the retrenchment package merger is very similar to that. Now, what you have is we've introduced in prior years that when you have a pension fund, you will have a retirement withdrawal, that's after you retire, or if you have an emergency because you've lost your job, is a pre-retirement withdrawal. And what that, if you'll see on the next slide, those two tables. Now, it's fairly simple. If you retire and you get your money out of your pension, you look at table one. If you need the money out before because you've lost your job or you've quit, you go to table two. Before, you had to go this massively complex formula, A, B, C, God only knows what, and your advisors couldn't explain it to you. So the key was your financial advisor, the FPI guys, the financial planning guys, whatever those guys are, they can explain it to you in less than 5 minutes. And the key was what we're trying to do is make sure that we can make it simple going through the front door and you won't need a lawyer explanation to get there. Now, what you're also seeing is that sometimes your employer will give you a severance payout. Say, look, I know you've lost your job, but here's an extra $30,000, $50,000, whatever, as an exit package. And what we've basically done is we've said that when you get a severance bonus, effectively it's going to go into that table, into the retirement table. And this is sort of designed to help you during the economic times. A lot of people having severance packages, they've lost their jobs, you put it in. But it used to be before there was a separate $30,000 exemption. There was a complex averaging formula, 510. If you ever look at that 510, it's quite a hell to look through that. We've got you out of that. It's fairly simple. Look at the retirement formula, and it fits in. But the one thing to note on all of these tables is they aggregate. So what happens is as you pull money out, you steadily face a higher and higher rate on all the tables. And the reason we do that is we don't want you pulling out your pension money before you retire. So you can get the money out. It does give you relief, but you do pay for it later on because we would prefer to have you save long term. So that's just the way this is, and it's all part of the overall schedules. Now, the other area that you'll also come into is that we're trying to get rid of all the lawyer engineering when it comes to employee salary issues. And one of the things that goes on is key person insurance plans. Now, generally, the way it works when it comes to insurance, if your employer provides you insurance, so if you die, you get an extra $100,000, generally what happens is the employer gets a deduction for paying the premiums. If they're paying the premiums on your behalf, you have fringe benefit income, but then when you pass away, it comes into your estate and everything tax-free. I'm not sure of the estate plan. I think it's tax-free in the estate, but that's my recollection. But we want everybody to go in that process. If you're getting a fringe benefit, we want it reported up front. We give the employer deduction up front. However, there are certain schemes where people begin to play around, and one of the games that's been done over the years is that the employer tries to pretend the insurance is for the employer's own benefit. So, and there is legitimate use of employer plans for this, and the kind of legitimate plan we're talking about is that the employer takes out a plan on behalf of key employees. Sometimes the key employees are, you know, if you lose the employee, the work level slows down. Sometimes you lose key contacts. Sometimes the employer actually has it arranged that he has to be bought out. And so what happens to these insurance plans is to cover the company for those plans. And if so, the employer gets a deduction. The employee does not have an inclusion. But some of these plans have been misused as disguised fringe benefits. And what's happened is, even though it's stated in the plan that it's for the employer's benefit, it really is going to go directly to the employee. And what happens in those schemes is that the employer gets a deduction up front, but the employee does not have a fringe benefit inclusion, does not have an inclusion until they actually get the benefit. And there's a little cottage industry around that. What we're basically doing is shutting down that industry. I think that's what the real proposal is. And what we're really trying to do is have revised criteria. If the employer wants to get a deduction for a plan for their own benefit, then you need to make sure that it really is for the employer's benefit. And there are a number of criteria here, some of the most important of which is the employer has to be the sole owner and sole beneficiary, that it really cannot be an investment plan. It's got to be in a risk-based plan. And then when you look at it, you want to make sure that ultimately the money doesn't go over to the employee. So if there's a plan, if there's a scheme to give it to the employee, it also undermines it. However, we did see one shortfall. In the employers who have legitimate plans, they often do it and they let the bank have a right to get the proceeds. And under current law, what happens is that if you want to have the bank be protected under the plan, it's sort of an insurance plan as collateral for the bank, it doesn't work for a key insurance employer plan. And we've allowed that to make sure that legitimate plans are okay. Then what you see on the next slide is just, if you promise us you're not going to give it to the employee and you eventually do give it to the employee, we smack you and we give you a denial of a deduction and we take away certain benefits. So even if you promise and then suddenly you change your mind, we come back at you and we say we didn't really believe your promise in the first place. So it comes back at you. Okay, now this is another area on what we're looking at. This is more of a savings issue. We have incentives to save. We want you, if you put money in the bank account, you get tax-free interest. So you get tax-free interest up to $22,300. If you're under 65, you get tax-free interest up to $32,000 above 65 and above. Now, these are saving incentives. To just note, these were never initially intended as savings incentives. These were administrative rules. And the administrative rule was really just a rule of administrative convenience for everybody so you don't have to worry about it on your turn. However, as time has gone on, they've become a savings incentive. And they're becoming fairly large. But if you look at it when it comes to people below 65, the exemption of $22,000, if you're going to your average bank account, you're getting about 6.5% interest. So to get to that level, you've got to have somewhere between $250,000 to $300,000 in the bank. That's a fairly substantial size of money to be tax-free. Fair enough, we'll do that for genuine savings. However, as the thresholds have increased, so is the tax planning. And what has happened oftentimes is that many sole proprietors try to disguise their shares and just with debt. And what they do is they try to pull money out of the company. Instead of bearing STC, they want to get it out as tax-free interest. And there are a number of little tax family planning schemes and others that are trying to generate a benefit off of this incentive. And the real purpose of the incentive is to promote savings in the general economy, not to shift money around. Now, there are some true family savings vehicles that are there that might come under some discussion. But overall, we find this is going to be a general general deadweight loss to the fiscus. And so what we've done is we've revised this overall regime, which is on the next slide. And we've said if you're going to get the interest exemption, we really want it to come into the overall economy. So if you have bonds on the JSC, if you put money in the bank, if you invest with a retail savings bond in government, you got friendly societies, your medical scheme, all of those are in the general economy. There's no real opportunity for tax avoidance, and there the exemption will continue. However, other areas will not, and it's really going after the closely held companies and schemes. But that, I have a feeling, will be a discussion in the hearings. Okay, another areas that come into savings is the retirement annuities. There's always a series of very complicated rules when it comes to retirement savings. And over the years, we keep coming back, and we simplify, and we're still trying to do that even further. One of the things that comes into play is that when you retire and you get a lump sum, you get the special table. So the question what happens is sometimes people convert their retirement after they retire. So, for example, on they retire, they'll get a lump sum and they'll get an annuity. What happens sometimes is that annuity becomes so small that it's not worth keeping in annuity form and you want to convert it into a lump sum. But if you do that under current law, you have ordinary revenue. So you get punished for that conversion into a lump sum later on, even though it's not efficient to keep it in the vehicle. And what we said is if you do a post-retirement conversion of a lump sum of an annuity, that also gets the special retirement table. Similarly, sometimes you'll have an annuity to your family, to your wife, to your children. And they'll also want to convert it into a lump sum for various reasons. And if you do that, they will go on their retirement tables and they'll just jump in that way. So we've clarified that law. Then there's just technical anomalies here. When you have umbrella funds, typically when your employer leaves a fund, when a fund is terminated, you go into the lump sum formulas. Sometimes what you have is an umbrella fund, which are typically industry funds. And there what you'll have is many employers in a fund, and they're putting themselves in an umbrella fund in order to save money. Because if they all have their own fund, it's expensive. So they put the fund together. What it turns out is if the employer wants to withdraw from one of those funds, then you're going to have a pull out of the fund, and most likely the money is going to go to the individuals when they pull out. And right now, that technically does not qualify as a valid pension fund. And it also violates the preservation fund rules. And so we're basically streamlining the process that if an employer wants to pull out of the fund, there won't be any adverse tax consequences. That's all it is. It's just streamlining that. And the reason why that's come up is due to the economic downturn. Employers have had to pull out because they can't afford to keep contributing. Now here's yet another one. Coordinating fund payouts. Okay, you've got, this is all the payout rules. If you have a pension fund and you lose your job, you can pull the money out. Hopefully you'll put it into a preservation fund and you won't take it out in cash. We've had rules around that to make sure that your general predilection is to keep the money in the fund. Then you can retire. If you retire, you can get an annuity or you can get a lump sum. After retire, you can still have a lump sum if it's small. Other times, the annuity can go to your children or to your spouse. They can also convert to a lump sum. There's a whole series of conversion rates. That's what I'm telling you. There's another situation where sometimes you have a pension fund that's for your own benefit, but you might find that if you owe the money to somebody else. The most common is you might use your pension fund to back up a house as collateral for a house, and it turns out you can't pay on your house, in which case the money is going to go out to the bank, not to you, if you can't afford to pay on the house. Similarly, if you steal money from the employer can get the pension money back. There might be other debts that also might be attached. So the problem is if the money actually goes out to a third party for these reasons, the tax rules become a big mess. And they start jamming up where it's not clear how to tax the money when it goes out. It also affects you when you actually want to pull out your own money. And basically what we're doing here is we're streamlining it so that a third party payout is treated like any other payout. Now back to the employer-employee world. In the world of employer-employees, what you see over the years is what we want to make sure that when you get paid cash, you're going to be taxed, and if you're paid in barter, you're also taxed. We don't want to give you an incentive as a general matter to switch cash salary into barter salary, basically. However, there are exceptions where it's really for the benefit of the employer, and that's what's being discussed here. Under current law, the employer can cover some of your professional membership fees, subscriptions. And that's really for the benefit of the employer, not you. And therefore, it's tax-free. However, those rules needed some adjustment. They weren't quite in line with reality. And so what we've done is we've clarified the rules and said professional dues, where they're really beneficial for the job that you're doing and they're a precondition for practicing, that's going to be exempt, and we just clarified the rules around there. But then we've also added one. Sometimes the employer is covering your insurance. So you may be a doctor, lawyer, accountant, or whatever, a builder, and you may have messed up. And you as an employee want insurance in case of your mistakes, and that's really something that you're not doing as a personal benefit, but it's really part of the job. And if your employer covers those kind of premiums, it is not a fringe benefit to you because it's really, again, for the benefit of the employer. Okay, now here's another area that you'll see every year, year after year after year after year, and that is the executive share schemes. Rich people don't like to pay tax, neither do poor people. Rich people get out of tax with lawyers. Poor people get out of it other ways. And you'll find that one area that's very popular, and you've seen a lot of newsworthy stuff, is share schemes. Okay? Phantom share schemes, Enron schemes, whatever you want to call them. People like option bonus schemes. And one, you want to make sure to cash out so that the shareholders don't realize what you're doing. That's what Enron was all about. But while you're taking advantage of your shareholders, you also want to take advantage of the fiscus. And it's very hard for executives to believe, but when they get salary, they should be taxed at ordinary revenue, and they don't like that. So they go back to the attorneys again and again to come up with new schemes. And what we enacted several years ago is 8C that says, if you get shares, we will tax them as ordinary cash salary when you convert those shares into cash. That's what we put in. And the number of schemes that come up keep reemerging. And it's amazing how us lawyers can devise things when it comes to property law, of what's a property right, what's not a property right, what's an election, what's not an election. And what you see here is yet further schemes that we're closing down. One is you might, the typical scheme that you see is that you'll get a share scheme, where you get shares and they'll be restricted shares. And the reason why they're restricted is the employer doesn't want you to cash out until you leave the company or until 5 years later. And you don't want to cash out either, because what those shares are, and those share incentive schemes are, is growth of the company. You get a piece of the growth, so 5 years later. And what the basic rules say is when you cash out, you'll be taxed. But already we've had problems to try to get around that. One is you might get the share, and you might hold on to it, but it might distribute a dividend or distribution. And there, that is a cash out and should be taxed at ordinary revenue. A number of schemes have developed around that, which I think will be shut down. Second is people will play games to artificially cash out when they have no gain. So the game here is I've got the shares and I have a bonus of one rand. What I'll try to do is at the time the bonus is worth one rand, I'll try to convert that out and have a tax on the one. Then the growth on the one share will go up to 100 later on at a 99 level. And then you'll get tax to capital gain rates. What you're trying to do in all of these games is accelerate the disposal event so you convert ordinary revenue into capital gain. That's really what's happening here. What you see in a number of schemes is instead of getting the growth, what I will do is I will swap my shares with my colleague. And I'll swap them at a point before the growth happens. And then I'll get, the growth will be subsequently taxed at lower rates. And we've shut that down. Similarly, employees will purchase from you before the growth really happens. And they'll also play games around that. And what we've basically done is shut those schemes down. But these schemes are getting very difficult. And one of the problems is we want to make sure we stop the scheme, but without going after the fair use of what you're doing. And it's a very difficult balance in there. And I have a feeling you'll hear a little bit about this as we go forward. It's those are the proposals there. Okay, now we're on the site.
Great. Good morning, all. Chance for Keith to catch his breath and rest his voice and have a little water. Thanks, Chair and members. Standard income tax for employees. What is it? Why is it there? It's something of a historical artifact. It was introduced back in 1988 as an administrative simplification. And to be an administrative simplification, what it had to do is make a bunch of assumptions. So essentially, the assumptions were that you're going to be employed for a full year by a single employer, that your salary wasn't going to change very much, that you weren't going to have any other deductions, other than those that your employer knew about, and you didn't have any other income. And if all of that was true, then it was a final tax. So you didn't have to submit a tax return. Now, as time has moved on, we've become more electronic. Employers are able to submit their IRP5s to us electronically so that we can track what specific employees are doing. And for that reason, essentially, we've never adjusted the cap on the site threshold. It applies on remuneration, salaries, and benefits of up to 60,000 rand. And as you can see from the last bullet there, this year that we're in currently, the financial year, the tax threshold is going to be 57,000. So there are not too many people who should be left in the site system. Now, the idea then is, well, let's phase it out. It's served its purpose. We've replaced it with technology, with the ability to, in fact, track employees electronically. And, in fact, as you see there, we're able to say that taxpayers with remuneration up to 120,000 rand need not submit a return. And as we become comfortable with that concept, we may increase that 120,000 rand to, say, 200,000 or whatever. But technology has essentially moved on and we're able to do away with sight. The problem, though, is what happens if you've got somebody who has two sources of sight income? Okay, it shouldn't happen really, but it does, because people may have two sources of employment, or they may have employment and perhaps a pension. And so what's going to happen now? Well, sight, as I say, works on a bunch of assumptions. And one of the assumptions is that you have a single employer or a single source of income. So when you have two sources of income that are under sight, both employers are giving you your rebates and your exempt thresholds. So each is then under-deducting the tax that they should in terms of the sight system. And so when sight moves from being a final tax to simply employees' tax as anybody else pays, you're going to have a sudden shock to the system, because people are going to see that whereas under the old system perhaps they had a few hundred rands worth of tax to pay, they now have a few thousand rands worth of tax to pay, because you're adding the two together now as income. Before, you didn't have to do that. Before, each was considered as the only income you had by each employer or pension administrator. So what are we going to do? Well, those taxpayers have had an advantage that no other taxpayers ever had, because any of us sitting around this table, if you have more than one source of income, you have to add up and you have to pay that extra tax in. But bearing in mind that these people are probably at the lower end of the income spectrum, having to pay some extra tax is going to be that shock to the system I was talking about. So what we're going to do is, and what we're proposing we should do, is phase it in over 3 years. So allow people to continue to have this benefit that they've enjoyed since 1988, but bring them in line with all other taxpayers, but not immediately, over 3 years. And essentially, as you can see there, what we're talking about is phasing a third in over each year, so that by the third year, they're in the same position that everybody else is in. Presumably, if all goes well, by that third year, we'll have also adjusted the various exempt thresholds and so forth. So, again, that will be a source of relief for them too, as it will be for all other taxpayers. That's the first two bullets there. The third bullet highlighted just another issue, is that this concept or the problem of having to pay in some extra tax on assessment is not unique to site taxpayers. It does occur for some individuals who are in the normal tax system as well. And so we're going to be looking at how we can assist those taxpayers to manage their cash flow, because, again, they have to pay up some extra tax on assessment. It would be more convenient if they would pay that tax in over the year rather than in one lump sum. Of course, some taxpayers might prefer to pay it all in one lump sum at the end of the year. But for some other taxpayers, it, as I say, is something that they're not planning for when they get the assessment. They say, oh, where am I supposed to get this bit of extra cash? So we're looking at ways of assisting those taxpayers. We'll be doing that over the course of this year. Some of the options are simply education. I mean, SARS could, in fact, do a letter to each of these taxpayers saying, hi, we notice you're in that situation. Here's some hints on how you can not get into that situation. And then there are legislative amendments that we could also propose next year if that doesn't do the trick. Professional sports. Should I take that one? Okay. A couple of years ago, we made a change which essentially said that professional sporting bodies are permitted to claim a deduction for the assistance that they give to the development of amateur sport. And the idea there is that professional sporting bodies are taxpayers just like anybody else. So you're doing it on a professional basis. There are no exemptions. You're a business. But in order to get players into your top league teams into the professional bodies, you need a feeder system of amateur sport. Because playing Bafana Bafana doesn't just appear out of nowhere. He played at club level and then moved up into the professional leagues and finally comes out at the top of the system. Now, the idea then is that if you develop your amateur sport, you can build that feeder so that you can get your good players out into the professional system. And so it's a business expense for those professional bodies. So what had happened previously is that the professional body, sporting arms, had broken up into two legs. Sporting bodies had broken up into two arms. The one arm would be the professional, which was fully taxable, and then the other arm was the amateur, which was a tax-exempt body. In reality, the amateur arms don't have much income. So what we then did is we said, okay, look, in order to rationalize the situation, you'll be able to pull the two back together again and then just have them in a single body. Now, problem is, a lot of people who'd want to do it found that it was a lot more difficult than they thought they could, that it would be, because you've got a whole bunch of different people who've got different interests that you're trying to get back into a single body. That's complicated. So the deadline, difficult. Some bodies didn't want to amalgamate, again, for sometimes very good reasons, sometimes for other reasons. And then there's one last issue that also arose, which is that in the professional sporting world, you can have very lumpy income. In other words, you have a World Cup or something of that nature, which you get lots of money in now, and you're going to use that to develop your amateur arm over a few years. So you can't spend it all in 1 year. So being able to get a deduction in 1 year doesn't really help you, because you want to take that money and invest it in amateur over a period. So what are we proposing? Well, one is easy. We give an extension for the people to amalgamate, who wish to amalgamate. And then for those who can't amalgamate, we're saying that you don't have to do it all in a particular body. You can have a professional body that will fund an amateur body. And finally, because you have this lumpy income problem in the professional sports world, what we're saying is where you're going to use some of that income for developing your amateur sport will allow you to create a reserve for that to carry forward and then spend that money over a number of years. And so that hopefully will resolve the problem for our sporting codes, and they will be able to bring us the kinds of players we'd like to watch and pay for.
I don't think there's too much to be said here. Look, when you look at the world of public benefit organizations, there are two benefits that are available. If you are a qualifying public benefit organization, you are exempt for your public benefit activities. And for the preferred public benefit organizations, when you make donations, you get a deduction. That's always nice when you try to sell a thing. It's deductible if you give us a donation. We used to be very restrictive when it came to donations to PBOs, and the list of who was eligible for a deduction was much smaller. At that time, there was a big debate around transfrontier parks and whether a donation there could be deductible. And given the importance of the issue, it was ultimately decided that it should be deductible, but we put it on a test basis where there was a sunset clause. And the sunset clause was about to expire, and the question was, should we renew the sunset clause or how should we go? And basically, the transfrontier parks have been very successful. And one of the things that has happened is that all donations for environmental public benefit organizations are now deductible. And this is mostly an environmental thing. It's also a Peace Park thing. Mm-hmm. But we said, look, if the environmental PBOs, donations to them are deductible, these should be deductible. And we made them deductible on a permanent basis. And that's all that was. Okay, now I think we want to jump to indirect tax. So we got to...
I was just suggesting we take a break for questions, Chair. Otherwise,
that's a good idea.
We ourselves might fall asleep, aside from others.
Thank you, Treasurer. Honourable members, can I give you this opportunity to interact with Treasurer on their proposal? I will take the first round of hands and continue with the rest later. Mr. Lienge, Honorable George, Honorable Chwete, Goronov, that fish, in that order.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think, Chair, this interaction is actually assisting us as members or members of Parliament, as well also public representatives. And I would appreciate a situation whereby these engagements are actually extended to the public that we are representing, not only the elite representatives of the public, these NGOs who will say we are community-based organizations at this level. So it would be proper if we go to the local level and engage people. I would like, Chair, to get more elaboration on the kilometer versus against the claims. What is going to be repealed? Is it the kilometer the kilometers that we used to be paid for if you have travel claims? Can I get elaboration on that? And also the issue of this Islamic funding. I mean, we are in South Africa. We are now busy debating something about Islamic. Some of us, we don't know what Islams are. Where are they? Where do they come from? Now we want to cater for them in our in our laws. Are we also catered for in other countries if there is an origin of those people and communities? Is this an international trend? I mean, this one is questionable, and as we are going to maybe engage communities, it's not going to be very easy. Then on the emissions, Chair, is it as a result of the pollution status of South Africa? Because South Africa in Africa is the best polluting. So is this a form of responding to that? Or if that is the case, are the best polluters in South Africa, are they going to pay more? Or what is going to inform the taxation on emissions? On the pre-retirement withdrawal, I think it's a clarity seeking one. I would love this one. If you say pre-retirement, I've got something in mind that says we have Honorable Trete, who has been in Parliament for the past 10 years, and no, Honorable Trete, not you, has been in this one for the past 10 years, and he or she feels like accessing some of his or her investments, and unfortunately those investments are made to a particular company which is governed by the laws. So is this pre-retirement clause allow an individual to access an investment of which was made for retirement? So if I can get clarity on that. Then on the party withdrawal, the partial withdrawal, maybe you are saying a tax-free bracket, maybe it's 25,000 for someone who is below the age of 65. So if one wants to avoid that taxation bracket, can you allow that person to withdraw less and maybe 3 months down the line or within a particular year, he or she withdraws another amount? Is it going to be allowed that one is actually saying, I'm withdrawing this amount in order to avoid tax? On sporting bodies, I'm very happy with the explanation around the sporting bodies. It is very clear, the amateur and the professional one. So how do you regard churches? Are the churches as these bodies like sporting bodies? There are churches, denominations at this level, and then you have your mainline churches, maybe as a federation. Is there any contemplation maybe to drive them to a particular contribution? If that is the case, how do they? How is the amendment, or how is this a bill treat churches as those organizations? They are social, at the same time they are non-governmental organizations. Others are calling themselves community-based organizations, but there is money involved because they collect money. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to ask a question relating to the Moneyball's Amendment and Related Matters Act. In March, we did approve the fiscal framework, and we did approve the revenue proposals that were attached to the fiscal framework that then yielded the result on page 9 regarding the tax proposals. So, theoretically speaking, we have actually approved already what is now in this bill, unless there are extra things that are coming through. If not, then my question is, we're now going through a process where we are looking at the proposals, we're looking at the bill, and then we're going to be hearing the public on it, and then we're going to be making some kind of conclusion. So in theory, it could be changed. And if that is the case, then what would the impact then be on the fiscal framework and what we've already done to date? So I'd just like to have some clarity on that. So does this bill include only those items that were previously raised, or are there more? And if so, shouldn't they be separated? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to align myself with Dr. Lienge when you say these issues that are raised here are issues of the public. And when I was asked to come here, I was saying, what am I going to do, because I know nothing about and only to find it's the issues that are affecting us directly. So I'm very happy that I'm here today. My question is already asked by Dr. Lien. It was around pre-retirement clause. Then that one is covered. The other one is on slide 32. You've alluded to shares. If you convert shares into cash, they get taxed. And then when you buy shares, you want to have money. The reason for you to buy shares, you want more money. So what is the best thing? Is it do you sell, or you don't convert them into money? What is the best option if you have shares? And the last one is around professional bodies. Professional bodies, you said you ask them to amalgamate the professional and amateurs. If they don't decide not to, the amateurs, do they get taxed? Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Mine is on these two, if a person is getting two incomes. Now, there was a proposal one time by Trevor of saying, why don't you bunch together these two incomes so that deduction are made monthly, people must not get a shock at the end of the month. Because that is what is happening. You get a shock when a lump sum amount has to be paid back by you. Yeah. Another thing that I would like to know is this question of the pay as you earn. Now that the sophisticated electronics are being done, on the question of assessing the money to be deducted from an individual, how is it then that at the end of the year, you always find a situation where you still have to pay some money I mean, you know the salary a person is getting right through the year using electronic, then the deduction should be exact so that you must not get a shock.
Honorable Gorenov.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just have a couple of general questions. I haven't read the Bill of Standards yet. I will do that in a couple of weeks. But just reacting to the presentation, the first item, quite often Mr. Hengel said, we are shutting this down. And that evokes in my mind the image of a gate that falls down and there is a poor chap underneath that gets squished like in a cartoon. And every time you shut something down, it effectively changes the parameter of legality. It was legal before and we are making it illegal. Which begs the question of what happens to those who rely on doing something because it was legal and then it becomes illegal. And it depends on the situation. I want to raise a question in respect of where perhaps that effect is the most detrimental with the key insurance, with the key personnel insurance plans. I accept the difficulty put before us. But obviously there are people who have relied for 20, 30 years on that possibility. And I accept they may have made the key personnel insurance plan a part of their estate planning. And effectively diverted what would have been taxable income into an estate asset by bypassing the taxation process. But it was legal. Should we not have a grandfathering provision? So henceforth you can't do it. You did it before. That was the law. Because otherwise it's the retroactive effect seems to be particularly unfair. The second point I'm raising, it's controversial, but I mean, and I don't know whether this is the committee in which should be raised, but it is before us. We are taxing people on carbon emissions on the assumption that that is good for the environment because there is global warming. Yet nobody in his right mind, not even Al Gore, speaks about global warming anymore. The word expression global warming has been eliminated because the world is not getting any warmer, it's getting cooler and the glaciers are moving back. All theory of global warming has been abandoned. We are now dealing with climate change, a set of random effect in climate changes. But there is no proven relationship between reducing carbon emissions and dealing with the effect of climate change. But we're going to get in tax for it. And to me that sounds very much like taxing on windows. And It's a thing on which we can tax. So just these two questions, if I may, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Honorable Anderson.
I think we'll all answer, but maybe I'll just deal with some of the general points on the process and so on. I think that the point made by the Honorable Member on taking the discussion to the public is quite an important one. The tax laws are probably, though, the most complex bit of legislation that you have. And I often tell Keith, sometimes when you have the hearings, I don't know if anybody's got the Income Tax Act, or VAT, you'll see they thick pieces, books. And what we deal with every year are amendments to the legislation. So, therefore, what you're only getting is not... So firstly, it's complex because of just the way you do amendments in any bill is you say add this, repeal this, you have square brackets, you have bold, etc. So it's impossible to read the legislation on its own. Okay, it's a process to even read it with all the other legislation. Hence the explanatory memorandum. Secondly, I think what it means is because we're dealing with new issues, we're not dealing with what's already there. So to give you an example, if you're dealing with sports bodies, there are other incentives already there. This, on the margin, is just a new option that's given. So, you know, some of those options, if they don't want to use, they don't have to use, but it's just to facilitate often. Okay, so that's what some of the measures do. Yes, there are other measures where we close down loopholes, and generally we try and only make these apply going forward. Normally the bill will take effect
after promulgation,
you know, after in January or whatever, and sometimes if it's going to take longer, like you see the side thing, it's phased in over 3 years within the measure. So, you know, we obviously know that if you're going to make a measure retrospective, that would, sometimes it has to be done, and has been done, but that's in extreme cases. And of course, you make some of the benefits retrospective in the sense that you could, as Parliament, reject all the lower rates proposals that we have. But nobody objects that even those measures will be retrospective. They'll be from the 1st of March, right, from the tax year, because it's a beneficial thing. And of course, we've also made a pre-announcement on the rates. The announcement was done in the middle of February before the tax year started. So generally, I don't think that's also retrospective, because in a way the expectation is once the minister's announced, he's saying the lower rates will take happen in 2 weeks' time. But tax is not just about the rates, it's about the tax base, and that's where the complications and the tax avoidance issues come in. And that generally we try and make it only in the future. We allow for public comment if there are difficulties, so there's an element of grandfathering. And where sometimes we really have to be retrospective, then we bring that to your attention, and you know that we have to act sometimes decisively. But that's really the exception rather than the rule. And to the extent that maybe that I don't think it's there in this bill at all, beyond what I've said, that all the announcements are apply after when it was announced on Budget Day, and many apply later when the actual bills take effect. So just to make the other point, because this is an amendment bill, what we do, and you know, I also think that religion and politics are an explosive mix. Some of those measures, and Keith will talk through, there are provisions if you give to your local church, because they're treated as PBOs and so on. So it's already there in the system. What we then do is often there are constituencies, whether they're sports people or whether some people are so religious they don't want to accept interest, that you allow for products that they can also get a similar tax deduction that others use because there's an interest deduction. So kind of tax policy on the margin, and Keith will go into those in detail still. He'll answer, and we haven't done it in a... So we'll come to some of those, and we'll answer it at the time when he's dealing with it. So you'll see exactly how, in tax policy, we're trying to reach different groupings of people who have different interests, different products, and how that comes in. But I think the question you pose on how do we make this more public, you know, sometimes I wonder, why doesn't Parliament make that parliamentary channel a free channel so that everybody can watch these? Because SAPC does cover just the plenary sessions, and I often think the more important work is actually what's done in these committees. But even that satellite channel you have, I don't know who are the people running it, but I think they run it so badly. One, they don't tell you what's coming, it just comes. I don't know why it's not 24 hours like C-SPAN. If you go to the States, I mean, that thing runs 24 hours. If something was there in the morning, it runs. And even if they can tell you what's coming, I think it would be a great service to the public. And I wish you as parliamentarians can be militant, and I don't know if Parliament subsidizes that channel, but not only subsidize it, make it more accessible, have times. Because even whilst we're at work, whilst this is happening, we don't even know whether it's on that channel. If it is, we would like to get our staff there to watch this for ourselves. And honestly, there's no certainty. So to the extent that there are those proposals or any others about how to make it accessible, we're certainly open to it. But having said that, tax proposals are very complex. And what we have here, because it's an amendment to current acts, it's on the margin that we're giving you the new proposals that come through. The other question I want to deal with is Dr. George's question, which is a difficult question. And it doesn't just apply to the text proposals. In theory, once you've given the new process that we have, but in theory, if you the division of revenue bill only gets accepted thereafter. If Parliament change that Schedule 1 and change the amounts between the three spheres, in theory you'd be changing the national budget, the nine provincial budgets, and 200 and, I forget the number, 84 municipal budgets and entities. So, you know, you can wreak havoc in a sense, but that is your, obviously that is your not the right to wreak havoc. I mean, the right to amend the budget is certainly your right and an essential democratic right. And so, so because the year already starts, and by the time you accept all the budget proposals, you as members of parliament have to be mindful that if you make changes immediately, that could disrupt. And getting back to the text proposals, yes, I think implicitly you've accepted the revenue levels, okay, and the deficit level, the fiscal framework. To the extent that you amend many of the proposals, unless you're going to really change the rates or differ on that, the other stuff is not necessarily always revenue significant, will not change the big numbers that materially. But having said that, there are certain measures that could change it materially. You could say you don't want an environment tax. It could be raising $3 billion. And in a sense, you then need to say, okay, if that is not raised, how do you deal with it? You can deal with it either by having another measure here to make up for that amount, or there is the adjustments budget that's coming, and you would try and deal with the changes on a fiscal framework at that point. So I'm just saying that that's a hard question. You have the right to do it. But having said that, I do think it's quite important that a lot of these are not necessarily all revenue sensitive and dealing with the tax base. And yes, it has some impact, but I think it's very important that as Parliament you do go through it. And in fact, we are very open to making some of the changes. Hence, in the process, the Minister of Finance, I think, has to make comments if there are proposed changes. Because if there are serious imbalances that result, then you as Parliament have an opportunity to assess and get a formal response from the Treasury. But I think that doesn't need, you know, these changes are not necessarily that significant immediately. So I think just in terms of the broad approach, I would say that's how we would see it. But perhaps if Cecil can start with the specific issues that are raised. And as I said, some issues will come to, and just mention that what you'll come to in the presentation.
Thanks, Momo. Madam Chair, I'll try and answer two questions, and then I have to run, Momo. Maybe let me start on the travel allowance, the company car issue. We have made the change last year already, I don't remember, where you had two options previously. You could claim actual kilometers traveled by keeping a logbook, or you could claim what we call in terms of a deemed kilometers. So you're saying that we deem the first 18,000 to be private and anything above that is business. That we've done away with already. So as from the 1st of March this year, you have to keep a logbook in order to claim mileage. If you don't have a logbook, you can't claim. That's for travel allowance. What we're now doing is we synchronize that with a company car. And there is a certain regime if you get a company car instead of a travel allowance. We change the tax regime with respect to company car. And there we said where the deemed fringe benefit was 2.5% of the value of the car, it's now 4%. And then in the end on assessment, you can also claim provided that you keep a logbook. So those are the changes that we've made on company cards. Maybe let me skip to the run to the emissions tax.
Okay, I just want to say we did apologize. Mr. Morden has to leave for make a presentation in Johannesburg. So I would like him just to deal with one or two slides, and then we'll come back to the questions with your permission.
If you go to your slides, members, slide 88 and 89 deals with the emissions tax. Two members raised it. What we did last year, we proposed to change the ad valorem excise duty on motor cars to include a component which is emissions related. After comments, we've now changed that to make it a specific tax rather than a part of the ad valorem, and the ad valorem will remain unchanged. And so just to go through the mechanics of this thing, it will be applying to all new passenger cars at this stage. Commercial vehicles are currently excluded, that might be phased in over time. It will be based on the certified emissions of the vehicle. That is now being governed by regulations issued by the Department of Energy in conjunction with the South African Bureau of Standards. All new cars have to have a certified emissions when you buy a car. So based on that certified emissions, the tax will apply, and it's expressed in a very strange way. It's expressed in terms of grams emitted per kilometer traveled. And so for cars that have an emissions below 120 grams per kilometer, there will be no tax. For cars with emissions above 120, you'll be taxed at 75 rand per gram, and that will be simply a multiplication. As I said, we will explore commercial vehicles later on, and it doesn't cover used vehicles. And there are pretty good reasons why we don't cover used vehicles at this stage, or not intend to cover used vehicles, because used vehicles, you pay a license fee, and the license fee is based on the engine capacity, which is very close to the emissions also. And what we hope to do is liaise with provinces, who is the custodian of vehicle license fees, to maybe change it to also bring emissions more to the fore, but it's already implicit there. If you go to the next slide, you'll see a calculation. If you have a car with an emissions of 110 grams per kilometer, there will be no tax. And as you move up down the second column, the more the car emits, and I can actually put a column next to it and engine capacity, and you will see there's a very close relationship between the two. If it's a normal petrol or diesel-driven car, the number of emissions increase, and if you go to 1, 2, 3, 4, the fifth column, you'll actually see the difference between 120 and the actual emissions is the figure there. You multiply that simply with 75, and you get the tax. This also gives you an indication what the tax burden will be. If your car emits, say, 200 grams per kilometer, the emissions above 120 will be 80. 80 times 75 is 6,000. So you will pay a tax on 6,000. The average car last year of that type of car was in the region of 293,000, and that amounts to a 2% tax. And so those are just an illustration of the type of emissions. We didn't put name of vehicle next to it because it can be quite a range of number of vehicles, so we tried not to do that. So that's how the thing will work. To answer the question of whether we do the right thing of taxing carbon and whether carbon emissions has an impact on climate change or not, we can debate that. I'm off to a conference which actually are debating that as we speak. There's a summit on green growth, Madam Chair, and I think across the world, the carbon emissions is being either, it's properly priced either through emissions trading system in most of Europe. Some of other countries are doing it. The U.S. is struggling to get legislation passed, and we're proposing a carbon emissions tax. Those are my comments on that.
Can I just say we can argue about the science, but I think the growing consensus is that it might be cold one year or the next, but you still have global warming, but underlying that, the broader term is climate change, and I don't think we are in any doubt about the science. But of course, one doesn't have consensus on all of these issues. You can have different debates, but for the moment, I'm just saying we are premised on taking a view there, certainly. But let's move on.
Just the last one from my side is the question of the site in the two sources. If you can go to slide 35, Franz, and if members can look in the explanatory memo is also page 35 onwards. I think to us, the site reform or phasing out has brought to the fore this whole debate of people with more than two sources of income and how do you deal with it. Now, yes, in principle, people should during the year add their sources of income together and be taxed on it together. The problem is if you've got two different employers or two different sources of income, it's very difficult to do it because which employer are you going to talk to add it together? And as Franz has said, there are various options one can explore. You can educate the public and tell them, look, it's in your interest to pay more during the year. Or you can approach one of the employers and say to the second employer or the first employer, say, please deduct more from this particular individual. That might have other consequences because you then tread on person's individual privacy because now, as an employer, I know my employee has got a second source of income if it's two employers. Where it's probably not so difficult to do that is where you have a person that derives a stream of income from a pension of a deceased spouse and is also working. There it's not a problem then to engage the employee and also maybe the fund and say, look, this particular person has two sources of income, please deduct more during the year and you can go to that to the pension fund. And I think that to me would be the easiest. And a lot of widows find themselves in that position where they're still working, get a source of income because their spouse has died, and then are slapped with a huge bill at the end of the year. And we've received numerous letters to that effect, and I think we need to now, from an administrative point of view, try and deal with it more proactively. Thanks.
Let me carry on here a little bit. There were some tax planning questions. Obviously, whenever you get us before, people want to know about a little bit of opportunities and what have you. There was the first question on pension. Can we withdraw from the pension? Now, this is something that Momo was saying, is that current law allows you, when you're allowed to take money from your pension, when you're not able to take the pension, that is all current law, and we're not changing that. The only thing we're changing is that when you pull the money out, how you're taxed. And we're only changing that on the edges, not on the main. But the main question was, can I get money out of my pension? Well, I'm not sure which pension you're referring to. If it's the government employee pension plan and they're withdrawing from it, they have to leave the employer. So if you're no longer working with us, then you get a cash out at that point. So generally the goal is that when the employer has money and they're holding on behalf of your pension, we don't want you taking the money out and spending it and cashing it out. However, there are times where you can move the money around. Now, in the government employee pension fund, they save it on your behalf. You have a defined benefit plan. You get a certain percentage. Really, all the risk is on the employer, so it really doesn't matter from your perspective how they save, as long as they don't risk insolvency. But if you've got a normal, private employer, you often have choices. And they say, look, you can shift it from one set of investment schemes to another investment schemes, and you can move the money around within the savings vehicle. If you have an individual retirement annuity, again, you have a fair amount of free choices. So if you want to come back, we can come back on that question, but you really have to know more about the nature of the savings. Then there was another question about shares. What we're talking about is a very special kind of shares. I think the shares that you're referring to is if I go out and buy shares, so I have salary. I earn some money, I go buy some shares. When you go buy shares, that is not a taxable event. You're not taxed on the purchase. If you decide to sell those shares, however, then you will be taxed on them as a general matter. But if you don't have that much gain under, what is it, 11 or 9, what's the percent, the threshold now? Somewhere, it's about 15,000. But there's a threshold underneath, it's still exempt. For a small saver, when they sell shares, there is a level of exemption. so that they can freely cash out. It just if it's mostly your client base, your members, it's mostly they're going to fall under those thresholds. There's also a fair amount of freedom under collective investment schemes. So, but anyway, and I'll have to come back on that. But tax always gets that kind of planning. There was, look, the effective date question, I think, is a legitimate one. I don't think it's something that we're not mindful of. And I think, as a general matter, you will see our effective dates going forward. And the question is, what does going forward mean? So when we're shutting down, we're trying to get people to stop them generally from entering the plan and going into that space. But sometimes we have debates of how far that goes. I mean, for instance, if you come up with a tax-incentivized plan and you've been getting benefits off of it for the last 10 years, should we allow you to stay and continue to get benefits off of that? And that's where some of the peripheral battles come. I think generally when you're talking about the legislation I'm looking at, it's generally for transactions going forward. But there might be some issues around that. But I think that's generally the way we try to go deal with going forward as a general matter. When we talk about shutting things down, I know there are these people with gates falling on them, and we feel very sorry for them. But in the key thing to note is that if some people pay less tax, others pay more. And if rich executives don't get fully taxed on their salary, well, the money's got to come somewhere. If you go back to the beginning of those slides, we have a revenue shortfall. Now, if we don't tax them, well, somebody else has got to be taxed more, so that the PIT relief that you get will be a little less. And one of the issues when it comes to your constituency is when we come to the PIT tables, there's never much lobbying on that. Advisors don't make a lot of money on the PIT table. It's not an exciting thing for them. So, you know, we all want less PIT relief, but there isn't any hardcore lobbying that goes on around that. And so the special interests prevail because there's money there. There may not be money for you, but people get paid to do those services. And look, there's nothing wrong with that, just you know that you have a skewed thing. And this is when you get back to what Momo was saying, that we need to make sure that tax policy is more of a general wide thing, because if you don't tax you, somebody else has got to pay, or we've got to have one less program. This is a general budget, and how we allocate the money, it affects us all. But the issue of effective dates is important and should not be taken lightly. Now, just to mention the last one, the estate duty is unaffected here. So the ones I think you're referring to, those kind of schemes are totally unaffected. And there's a whole issue, as you know, that was in our budget review as to how we should deal with the estate duty and whether that's worthwhile or not. That always generates a lot of emotions. Unfortunately, the estate duty never generates much money, but it does generate a lot of emotions and will continue to do so.
Not an estate duty tax. It's an estate duty question. As I understand the key personnel employment, the key personnel insurance issue, you have companies who make tax-free contribution towards an insurance, will then be paid into the estate of the deceased key personnel. And looking at that, I'd be the first one and say, hey, that's income. But as it stands now, this is fine. Somebody might have done it for 30 years. If the gate comes down, because you see, when it comes down, it's at the moment of death. It will come down retroactively, effectively, for the entire 30 years.
I was saying next time when you want to speak, you must raise your hand so that we can recognize you. Otherwise, we'll run a chaotic meeting if we allow everybody to do that. You can respond, kids.
I mean, we certainly take the point, but balanced against that is the question of how many tax systems you want to run in the country. Because the more grandfathering provisions you have, the more you are preserving a tax system as it existed at a particular point, and the more complexity you introduce into the system, because then depending on when something happened, and if this then continues into the indefinite future, you could be running with the 2009 Tax Act and provisions for a particular person or a particular group of individuals, but not for everybody else. And so that happens with the 2010 amendments and the 2011 and the 2012. So accepting your point, there are several balancing factors, one of which, at least from an administrative point of view, is how much complexity do you want in the system by having to maintain multiple systems into the future?
I think also it's a question of what people want is fiscal stability. Once they've got away with it, I can get away with it forever. But there is also people who are not stupid. People who are advisors often build a contingency clause. In most deals, you'll see a contingency clause. And it says, well, if the legislature changes his mind, then something else happens. So they're not, you know, without remedy. But again, there are levels. And I think here we generally, as a general matter, we like to go prospective. But there is a point where we don't want to give you into the indefinite future. Just a last question was you just on the pension one, just to close on the pension issues. If you take money out, say $25,000 now, and then you take another $30,000 later, you can't play games with the system. So the first $25,000 that's taken out is taxed one way. The next $30,000 goes up the table as if you took it 55 at once. So you look at all of those retirement tables over a lifetime. It's a lifetime table. It's not a yearly table. So that prevents a certain level of manipulation that's there. I think the other ones are dealing with sports and PBOs. And then, yeah.
Right. Just on the question of the taxation of churches. Churches, if they are legitimate churches, they're not for the benefit of a particular person, they meet the requirements we have in what we call our public benefits organization legislation, are exempt from tax. So when you put your money in the collection plate, it's probably exempt, and the church can then do its good work from that money. Similarly for amateur sporting organizations that don't amalgamate with a professional. Amateur sport, again, if it meets the requirements in terms of our public benefit organization legislation, which are there to ensure that this isn't someone trying to disguise private benefit as a public benefit, those would be exempt as well. So if you're thinking of the local soccer club or the local cricket club, which is purely amateur, it's exempt. Obviously, if they start getting into business activities and they start, I don't know, playing on the stock exchange and doing sort of more business-like things, that would be taxable. But to the extent that there are a group of individuals who are playing a game, they're exempt. The question of why can't we get it right if we're on the monthly deductions, it's because very frequently we're dependent on information that is only available at the end of the year. And let's take the travel allowance as an example. We don't know until you give us your tax return and you've told us how many kilometers you've traveled as to how much deduction you can get for your business travel and your private travel. So you've got things that are only given to us once a year. Now, I mean, we could go down a road where people report to us their business and private travel every month and then we could get a bit closer. But you can see that's a lot more difficult. People would then say, well, why do I want to submit monthly returns to SARS? More work for us, more work for you. So, again, there's a balance there. But some things you will only get annually. So travel allowances, for example, medical expenses, there's information that we will only get in your annual return.
Okay, honorable members, I want to suggest that we take a 7-minute stretch break, and when we come back, we continue with the rest of the sections on the presentation. Is that agreed to?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. 7 minutes. What time do you want to leave this house?
It depends on you. What time do you do?
No, we are here until late.
Okay, that's fine. But if you have
time
problems, let us know.
But no, I'm joking. Can we at least... what time is it now? 11:00. Yeah, 1:00, I think, is our latest.
That's when we start.
Can we try and finish in 30 minutes, please?
So what I'm going to try to do is push hard, but I'm not going to go through every amendment then. I'm going to go through the more important ones that I think you're more interested in, and then you'll have to hear the other comment on the other ones. Otherwise, I think it's going to be a little bit of a tedious exercise. But I do thank you for the questions. I think I'm impressed that you were able to listen to all of that, and that's quite good. So let's see what we can do here. Let's get to the first one. This one is important. It's improvement on government land. Now, there's some special funniness in Roman Dutch law that if you build on somebody else's land, your building gets owned by the person who owns the land. That's maybe not so funny, but I think that's just the way it works. Now, because that rule is a little bit different, there's been a whole different set of law that's developed. And if you are a tenant on somebody else's land and you build on that land, you're only able to get a straight line write-off. So if you have a 30-year, if you have a 30-year lease, you write it off over 30 years. What has happened is that government oftentimes doesn't want to sell land and enters into various forms of public partnerships. It's not a policy of government to surrender its land. So oftentimes what happens is government provides the land, the private sector provides the building. And they will have a write-off. And last year we made sure there was an amendment they got a write-off. At one time you didn't even get a write-off. The question became, though, is sometimes you're entitled to an accelerated write-off. And the one that Momo even has already mentioned is urban development zones. If you have an urban development zone, there's a special incentivized write-off. But the law didn't allow you to get that because you didn't own the land. And what we've done is we basically deemed you to be the owner, effectively, when you're building on government land so you can get the accelerated write-off. And what we were trying to do is promote those kind of public-private partnerships, loosely stated. They're not necessarily be a formal one. So I think most people will greet that, and that will assist.
And just to say, I mean, this was a measure that was introduced to try and reverse the inner city decay problem that you had. More?
Yeah, okay, I'm not sure. Okay, but I take your point. Okay, so then let's move on to the next one now. This is a fairly big one. One of the things that we worry about greatly is mismatch games. And what happens in the tax law is there are a lot of people who are very good with simple math. Now, tax law, when you think about it, is really just a very simplified math. It's word problems. That's all it is. Of course, it's with a very series of complicated formulas. One of the basic mismatches in tax is you're trying to mismatch real profit from tax profit. What you want to do is make real money and tell the revenue service that you're not making money. And if your tax lawyer can do that, he's worth a lot of money. That's the kind of guy that you're going to look to first. Just between you and me, we all kind of know that. Now, one of the games that's played is with financial instruments. Now, those are debt. Debt, it could be equity, it could be derivatives, options, all sorts of things. That's the playing ground for lawyers and otherwise. And one of the things that you try to do in the world of banking, especially, is you want to generate an interest expense, and you want to match it against exempt income. Now, so you get a deduction. Let's say you pay out 100, and you receive 100. Well, that's generally neutral for you. But if you play the game right, the tax man believes that you paid out 100, and that you've never received 100. Effectively, you're trying to create a mismatch. Now. But generally, the tax law doesn't like that, and the general rule of tax law says you can't do that. If you do that kind of mismatch, we will deny you the deduction, and therefore you don't get a benefit. However, there was a case called the Standard Bank case, where the Revenue Service was fighting the issue, and what happened was, in that case, the bank was borrowing lots of money for deposits, but a small amount of that money was being used to buy preference shares. And there wasn't a way of tracing. And the court was very generous and said, look, in that situation, the bank had a good motive, and it's only a small amount of money, and therefore, even though there's a mismatch, we'll let it go. Having said that, having the Revenue Service having lost that case, there are a lot of tax planning now relying on that case, actually misapplying that case, and saying we can do mismatch schemes if we're a bank. And so certain banks, whenever they enter a mismatch scheme, that's their first line of defense. They just throw this case out, and they're misusing it. And what we've done in the law is we try to reverse that. And we said, look, there is no reason why a bank can't trace. In modern accounting and modern systems, computers, etc., tracing is quite common. And not only that, when you use money, you know how you're using it. You're a bank. You're smart. You know what you're doing. So you've got to trace. And if you don't trace, we're going to presume you're up to something. And that's the way it's been done. Now, in the budget, we originally proposed something far more drastic. The banks came in and said it's not fair. The insurance came in and said it wasn't fair. They said, look, what do you really want? Specific tracing. And what we've done is we said, yes, we want specific tracing, and that's what we've done. So I think, having looked at the number of structures and schemes, this reflects the dominant commercial reality, but we'll find out in a few weeks if they say otherwise. Islamic financing now. Now, what is Islamic financing? Why is something going on here? And that is that, look, we're not trying to say that Islamic financing gets a preference. What we're trying to do is put everybody on an equal playing field. And when you're talking about Western finance is not affected by religion. At one time it was. In the old days, there was the Catholic Church, and they had a prohibition against interest and some other prohibitions. But one by one, all of those have fallen away, and religion and finance are now sort of a separate thing. But in the world of Islamic finance, there is a whole set of prohibitions. One is there's a prohibition against interest. There are other things, and some things actually make a lot of sense. One is materiality. They want to say that when you enter into a transaction, it's got to be backed up by something real, something tangible. And when you look at the recent derivative crisis, you can see there's some sense in that. But the Islamic world has a whole series of rules, and there's special Islamic accounting and so forth. And because of all these rules, they can't perform the same transaction the same Western finance can be done. So if you borrow money, you can't borrow it in the same way in Islamic financing. Similarly, if you get bank interest, you can't get the same thing. And what happens is, because you've got to do it differently, the tax consequences are very harsh. You'll set off double value-added tax consequences, double transfer duty. The income tax doesn't work right. And what you find is that Islamic financing becomes prohibitive because of the tax man. And so what we've done is we've reviewed this area, and there's about 10 forms of Islamic finance. What we've done here is we've looked at a few of the most common forms. And what we're basically trying to do is we're trying to say we're going to make it equal to Western finance because the net result is the same. How you got there is a lot longer, but the net result is the same, and we want to put you on the same path. So the first thing is the mudarabaha. And again, I always say these things wrong. But there, you invest with a bank, and the bank, instead of giving you interest, gives you a profit share. And if you're a small investor, you normally would get an interest exemption, and we're going to give you the same thing. That's all we're doing. Similarly, if you do borrowing, at the murabaha and the diminishing musharaka are just forms of borrowing. And what we're doing is eliminating all the adverse consequences, and we're treating it like interest, just as if it's Western financing. Now, this is part of a larger project. Right now, what we're focusing is domestic. We want to make sure that Islamic savers and Islamic borrowing can be done the same way. Now, it's to note that banks, ABSA, all of them, they all offer Islamic products. And what they offer them to Christians, Jews, whoever. You can do it if you want to. There's no restriction. But what we're doing is we're just putting them all on an equal playing field. Now, what the hope is what you're trying to do is build a local expertise so that ultimately Middle Eastern and Islamic money from outside the region can enter the region. And what you'll see is further amendments down the road trying to bring an international side. Here, we're just trying to regularize the domestic. And that's essentially what's happening here. And those are more details around that. We are meeting with the industry. They're quite happy with those changes. Let's see if we can go back. Do we want to? Okay, let's go forward into the next one. Okay, these are small business relief. Basically, what we're doing is we have a number of incentives. We have two main incentives for small business companies and micro businesses. Small business companies get a 10% rate and accelerated depreciation. Micro businesses can get out of the income tax into a simplified turnover tax. However, in order to do it, you're not allowed to hold interest in multiple companies. The reason why is we don't want a big business broken up into small businesses. However, the way we've drafted the legislation, it's a little bit overly prohibitive, and that is if you own a dormant company that's about to terminate, we say right now under current law that prevents you from getting the relief. Even if you're pending from Cipro with that company, there's nothing in it, and the only reason why you have it there is the regulatory authorities haven't eliminated the company. And in those cases, we've said, look, the multiple shareholding, multiple company prohibition does not apply to a company that's about to go defunct. So I think that was requested last year as a result of some of the responses we got, and we've given that. Okay, this is fairly simple. Under current law, you can do a company formation, merger, reorganization for all assets but plantations. For some reason, you can't do plantations, and that's just due to funny wording in the Act, and now plantations will be treated like all other assets. That's all that one is. This one, I unfortunately have got to get into just a little bit. Intragroup reorgs. When you do a company reorganization, you get rollover relief. You can move assets within a group fairly readily. Generally, it's a good thing. However, if you break up the group, you have a degrouping charge, which is a bad thing. And so most people want in the relief, but they don't want the degrouping charge. What happens, however, is if you have inventory, you generally would prefer not to have the relief if you have typical inventory that's rolling over. What we've basically done is said inventory gets the best of this relief without the degrouping charge. So I think most people will welcome this change. I didn't really want to get into it, but I have a feeling the commentators will. But it's generally helping them. Financial instruments as trading stock. This is another one. Generally what happens is in accounting, for inventory, you get the best of lower of. It's a lower of rule. So that if you buy something for 100 and it goes down in value, you write it down. And that's based on the principles of conservatism for accounting. Because when it comes to accounting, you don't want people overstating the books to the shareholders. The tax law generally follows that principle, but it's following it too far, and it covers not only your standard inventory, but financial instruments. The reason why is under old law, that's under old accounting, that's the way it worked. Under new accounting, financial instruments are treated separately. They're actually booked up and booked down. We have a separate rule under J9 that does that, and so here we're being overly generous to the taxpayers when we pulled out financial instruments. Dividends tax refinements, I think we just don't have time for that, but basically there are always further amendments to this dividend tax. It's set to come into effect as soon as we get those treaties signed. I think we just signed the Irish treaty. We've got about another 7 treaties to go. Let's just carry on. I think there'll be some discussion, but it's too minor. I think we don't have the time for these issues. It's generally relieving measures to make things easier on administration. I think most taxpayers will like those amendments. Okay, liquidating residential property companies. This thing has tortured us. Something very simple has gone awry. But what happens is under old law, people were playing games with transfer duty. And instead of selling property and buying a house, what you did is you put the house in a company. And then you bought the company shares. And that beat transfer duty. And in 2001 and 2002, we basically closed those schemes down with an elephant gun. We blew them apart. There are a number of people, though, that got trapped in that regime. And we provided them with a 2-year window to escape. But it turns out that that initial window in 2002 really wasn't generous enough, or something was wrong, or people didn't believe us, and they missed that 2-year window. So last year, okay, there's some views as to how generous we were, and I think I sort of support those views, but let's not go there. We reopened the relief again in 2009. And again, it was said that it wasn't generous enough, so we're extending and enhancing the relief to allow most of those things to take their homes and get them out of companies, as well as vacation homes. So you can get them out of companies and regularize your affairs. However, we generally liberalized everything. The only thing we've been very careful is We don't want to liberalize it. We only want to allow you relief from capital gains and transfer duty. We don't want this as a mechanism to avoid estate duty. So one of the things that has to happen is that if you want this relief, you must liquidate the company. We found that when we created the new relief, people were playing games around the estate duty. So you get the old relief, but as we go forward into the new relief period, it's more generous, but if you want that new generous rule, you've got to liquidate. Second thing is that some people are going to want this expanded further. We didn't expand this further because we didn't want to open this up to estate duty. So that's what some of the issues will be about, and we'll move on. Okay, company law reform. A lot of noise around company law reform. It's kind of interesting, this little thing. But look, the company law reform is generally, I think, a very good thing. And I think most of the bill is fairly good. I think there are a few technical anomalies in that bill that people are raising out of proportion. I think those things can be fixed. And if they are, I think what we have is a very good reform going forward. However, with company law reform, tax law and company law are somewhat closely connected. There are a number of principles in the tax law that are connected to company law. We've engaged with the industry. We've basically put down here what we've done is solve most of those issues. And so we're just aligning to make sure there isn't a problem and to just to modernize. And I think we should just move on from there. Okay, micro-business turnover tax refinement. Micro-business, again, it's a turnover tax. If you're a small business, you don't want to deal with the complexities of the income tax, you can have a simplified system where they just look at gross turnover, but it's taxed at a very low rate. We met with the University of Pretoria. They've identified a number of anomalies that made our regime more complicated. For instance, the transition rules getting in and out, some of the entry criteria was a problem. There was some duplication. We've cleared out most of that. Some of the real problems came with the turnover tax and the VAT. You can't be in the turnover tax if you're in the VAT. Why? Because if you can do the VAT, you can do complicated accounting. You can do all of your inputs and outputs. And we preserved the separation, but we've simplified it. One of these things, though, to note that's probably the biggest one is on the top of 59. And that is the current micro-business turnover tax does not allow you into the regime if you have any professional services whatsoever. One of the problems that we found is that oftentimes small businesses do a de minimis amount of professional service. For example, if you're in construction, you might do a small amount of architectural work or draftsman work, which is not core to what you're doing. And generally, we don't want architects in the regime because they're fairly sophisticated taxpayers already. They, you know, they've got a fairly high degrees and so forth, and they're making a high profit margin. And so, therefore, we want architecture out. But if it's a small percentage of what you're doing to support your overall business, we're going to allow it. And then there was a number of exclusions from the professional service rule that we wondered why they were there. We had taken it from an international list, and we've taken them out like entertainers. Now, entertainers are not sophisticated taxpayers. So we said, look, if they want to be in the turnover tax, fine. Now, maybe there's some rich guys in California, but given what our entertainment industry is like here, we're not seeing it. So we extended and we've pulled out a few prohibited professional services, basically. Just to one note on that, there was one other thing that was left over from last year, and that was the film incentive. We undertook to the committee that we'd be reviewing the film incentive. We have been engaging with them over the course of the year. We will probably get back to you next year on that, but we are meeting with them again in a couple weeks, and what we're trying to balance there is whether expenditure or the tax system or what we have makes any sense. I think the things are going rather well, and you can expect something next year on that, assuming the minister is happy with what we've done, of course. Okay, international. In the international arena, you're generally seeing more closure of avoidance schemes. A lot of these amendments are relating to what was talked about 2-3 years ago, these funnel schemes. This goes back, remember there was the empowerment schemes and the restructuring schemes, and there was media statements on this, and we actually had an empowerment seminar and all of this. And what we found was there was this funnel area. There was this area of this magic box offshore. And something funny was going on over there. And originally there was some proposals that would have affected the BE structures. And we didn't want to tackle them. We said, look, the BE parties are not to blame. It's the offshore funding. And what you see this year is we're clamping down on some of this offshore element. And really what's going on in a number of these things is the money is moving offshore with a deduction. So they take the money offshore and they get a deduction. And then they bring it onshore tax-free. Or they hold it offshore tax-free. And what we're really trying to do is clamp down on that and stop that. Because a lot of revenue is being lost unnecessarily. And I think one of the things that you're seeing, especially given our revenue pressures, is we don't want to be throwing away money. If we want to give a tax incentive, we want to get an economic growth for it. Or we want to give it because we're trying to help people out or whatever have you. What we don't want is homemade tax incentives where we basically create a hole in the fiscus. And that's what these are all about. And basically this is the first leg of it. And that is oftentimes people bring the money back on shore through tax-free dividends. Now generally we want you to bring money back on shore with tax-free dividends if you've earned and derived the money offshore. But if you've taken the money and you've earned it in South Africa and just shifted it around, that will be shut down. We went a little further and we went after preference share schemes as well. Because often those preference share schemes look like interest. I think that'll be some part of the discussion. But that's essentially what we're doing in those two slides. To move on. The other thing that's a little more contentious, and this we have to be very careful, is when foreigners invest in South Africa, their interest is generally tax-exempt. It's exempt by virtue of domestic law, and it's exempt by virtue of treaty in many cases. Now, foreigners get a benefit because they get an exemption. Now, why do we allow this? If you as a South African earn interest income, you're generally taxed. But if a foreigner gets it, it's exempt. Well, there's the real reason and the stated reason, okay? The real reason is, theoretically, the money is supposed to be taxed back in their foreign country. That's the theoretical reason. The real reason is the need for the U.S. to borrow money from the 1980s onward. In the 1980s, the U.S. was faced with big deficits. And what happened was, there was a weakness in one of their treaties with Netherlands and Tillys. And what happened was, is all the Europeans were lending them money through Netherlands and Tillys. And that money should have been taxed. And the late 1970s, under the Jimmy Carter administration, they went to crack down on that, to stop it. They weren't very successful. When the Reagan administration took over, seeing the deficits were growing, the U.S. began to say, wait a minute, I think we need to make sure that people continue lending to us. And so they made it across the board a fairly large exemption that said if you're a foreigner and you want to invest in the U.S. government, it's tax-free. That changed the whole playing field for the world. Because if you can invest in the U.S. and get tax-free interest, and you invest in South Africa and it's taxable, well, where are you going to invest? So governments around the world are now facing a situation where government money and generally portfolio interest needs to be tax-exempt, otherwise you're a competitive disadvantage. So we put in the rule in 1989 where we gave a blanket exemption to say that interest is going to be tax-exempt so we could compete. However, I think we went a little bit too far, and that's on the next slide, and that is, we went way too far in that, and it's opened ourselves up to the schemes. And where a lot of the schemes are, it's not genuine foreign investment. It's South Africans taking the money, pushing it offshore, and then bringing it back on again. And in order to stop those schemes, what we've done is we've narrowed our interest exemption to the capital we're trying to attract. And that is government bonds, bank bonds, JSC bonds, international trade finance, things that your retail investors, your commercial retail investors, will typically get a hold of. But where you can get the tax planning element is now excluded. Now, even here we have a problem because the treaty exemptions still remain. But it'll take out the tax haven element. And I think we've got it right from what I'm hearing, but we'll have some discussion around that. But that's part of the balance.
they have to go much faster.
Much faster.
Right, transfer pricing. This is something that I suspect we'll have a little bit of comment on. Currently, one of the risks the revenue faces is that people price transactions across the border incorrectly in order to trap profits offshore. So naturally, what we are permitted to do is to revise the prices to make sure that they are market-related and so that people don't artificially trap profits offshore. Currently, the legislation is framed in such a way that we adjust prices. But if you look at the international benchmarks and the international guidelines, you are, in fact, in limited circumstances also permitted to restructure transactions because the transaction may be structured in such a way that it is also not market-related. And essentially what we're doing here is we're aligning our transfer pricing provisions with that international benchmark. And we would obviously apply it in that manner as well. There's a fair amount of guidance on this if you go and have a look at things like the OECD's transfer pricing guidelines for tax administrations and multinational enterprises. Thin capitalization is linked with transfer pricing. This is when people push a lot of debt into your economy so that they can strip the profits of the local operation out through interest charges, taking advantage of what Keith has just been discussing. So essentially, we have a rule that counters that. That rule is based on a fairly strict anti-avoidance approach. Internationally, the thinking has changed over time that this should be applied more on an arm's-length basis, again, a more market-related approach. So that is what we're proposing for our thin capitalization rules as well. And now that Keith's had a chance to drink a little water, back to him.
Okay, this is a fairly big one. This is one of the things, that we've been working on quite some time, and that is it's been a big issue on Treasury to make sure that South Africa is a gateway into the region for, as a financial center. South Africa clearly has a major edge in this regard. We have a very strong set of banks, very strong set of insurance companies. We are really the financial powerhouse of the region. However, we have not been able to fully utilize that when it comes to investing into Africa. Now, we have, in all fairness, South African investment into Africa is stronger than a lot of others, but what we find is that we are not able to benefit from countries going through us. And if you look offshore, there's a number of tax havens. I won't mention them by name. But they typically, if you're an investor from Europe or the U.S. or Japan or elsewhere, you're using those tax havens to go into the region. And you're not using South Africa, one, because of exchange control. What we find is if the money goes into South Africa, you can't push it through. We've had a number of discussions with exchange control, and they'll probably jump it if they'd like, that to make sure that the money can be pushed through. But right now it can't go through. So South Africa is simply not a viable stopping location. The second is that we have a number of tax rules where they're really designed with the domestic economy in mind. And those rules are creating another layer of tax, another layer of administrative burden, so that if you're a foreign investor and you want to use South Africa as a regional headquarter, you can't use it effectively. And so we really haven't generated the kind of benefits we should be getting as a financial center. And what the proposals that you have here are trying to do that. Now, there are two kinds here. There's actually a number of variations of regional center companies. We are starting out with some more traditional ones, and then we'll work from there. And what you see here is two of them is traditional regional holding companies. That's one of the incentives. Not really an incentive. And the other one is a regional equity fund. But when we do these, we have to be very careful. One, we got to make sure that when we create one of these, that we don't blow a hole in our tax base. And one of the big worries we have in this area is that if we're not careful, people can use these things to do corporate migrations offshore. And we don't want our domestic companies misusing these to artificially migrate offshore. The second one is that there are rules against incentives in the international context that you cannot have harmful tax practices. And we don't want to be cited for that. That's not the kind of behavior we want. So we've been very careful to make sure that we don't create a harmful tax practice that will be cited by the OECD and others. It also undermines our effectiveness as a regional center. If you're a company in the listed markets in London or New York, when you invest in some of these tax havens, oftentimes you come under scrutiny. So you don't want to do something that gets South Africa listed as a tax haven, so it's listed in that prohibited behavior. Okay, basically we've got two things. We have the traditional holding company, whereas foreign company wants to set up a regional office that will invest into Africa. And that's what the first set of incentives is about. We've met with the industry. What we've come up here with a series of very simple guidelines where the qualifying criteria is very straightforward. And we wanted to make it straightforward criteria so it's easy to sell to clients. You can explain it in under 3 minutes to them, and they understand what you're doing, and we're trying to create certainty around it. We are still discussing with Exchange Control, but they've been very accommodating in that regard. As a matter of fact, they've been pushing us on our side. And what we've done basically with these rules is we've turned off three sets of issues. What we're saying is if money comes from abroad, goes into South Africa, and then goes out again, this is not really South African money. So it should be able to go through tax-free. And what we've done is we turned off something called the controlled foreign company rules. Dividends going out are basically tax-free, and the thin capitalization rules are pulled back, so that money can be shifted through via debt capital or share capital. That's essentially what we're doing. And we'll see whether it goes far enough, but I think there'll be discussions that they'll want it to go further. Then there's also regional equity funds. We have a very strong equity fund. We have the expertise. But when third parties invest in us, because of the tax rules, what happens is they get taxed in a way they shouldn't be taxed. Most third parties investing in equity funds are really like shareholders. They're limited parties. And generally a limited party is not taxed on passive income in South Africa. But because of some of the anomalies in the law, they are being taxed, especially under the permanent establishment rules. And what we're basically doing is we're turning those off. And what will happen is you're talking about equity funds, typically venture capital funds, but other kind of equity funds where the limited partner will invest in this. They'll be South African managers, and they'll invest in South Africa, or they'll invest into the region. And what we're saying is they will be treated like passive investors, these foreigners, and the foreigners will be basically exempt on their interest income and their capital gain income. And so I think that will help our regional, our collective investment schemes and our local venture capital funds. And this is just some of the tax consequences that are being assisted. Okay, these are currency conversion rules. We're just generally assisting taxpayers on their request when it comes to currency issues, and I think we can just move on from those. Okay, indirect tax. The value-added tax is generally pretty well settled. So what we're talking about when we change the value-added tax is very small technical anomalies. We have a very good value-added tax system. It's fairly pure. It's fairly simple. And we're generally just trying to make sure that it fits with commercial realities, or we're trying to stop certain avoidance mechanisms. Basically, what's going on here is that typically we have an anti-avoidance rule that says when you make a loan and you don't pay it back in 12 months and it's an unwritten loan, there's sort of a deemed charge that goes off. And what we're saying is in an intragroup context, that deemed charge doesn't make sense because the avoidance of concern really doesn't exist. And so that's all this one is about. When you are a bankrupt company, when you are a company that is deregistering from VAT, you have to pay back the VAT inputs you have. Now, the VAT system works that every time you buy an asset and you're a VAT vendor, you get a credit. And every time somebody else buys something from you, there's a withholding. But when you get that credit, it's on the assumption that you're going to have a corresponding payout on the other side. And when you deregister, you have to pay back all your credits. In some cases, there's a double charge, and we've removed the double charge. And that's all that we've done there. Let's move on. I think that's such a small anomaly. There's an issue. This one deals with the micro-business tax. There are some anomalies when you enter. You have to leave the VAT to enter the turnover tax. And what we've done here is we've just eliminated all the transition rules of entering and leaving just to make it simple. That's all that we've done on those. Okay, royalty. The royalty is just going into effect now, as of 1 March 2010. So while people have been looking at it for a long time, they're looking at it a lot more closely now. That's the way people are. And as they get closer to it, all of a sudden, all of these anomalies have gone off. So we have met with the industry a number of times to find out where all the anomalies are in the Royalty Act. And what we've done is we've cleaned up most of these anomalies. One of the big areas comes around stockpiles, that you take your minerals out of the ground and put it into a stockpile. And that was creating a whole series of problems. And what we've said is, if you take the minerals out of the ground and you put it in a stockpile, that is not an event. If you sell the stockpile to somebody else, that's not an event. But when that person takes the mineral out of the stockpile and then sells the mineral separately, then the royalty will apply. And that's all we're doing in this amendment. Similarly, we used to say that every time you took a mineral out of the country, you would get a charge. People said that was excessive, that it was interfering with things, and we spoke to the Revenue Service, and they said, look, we don't need to have a charge for taking an asset out of the country. We just need to charge it when it's sold. And we can track it from an accounting point of view, whether you sell it here or abroad. As long as the same company still owns it, it's fine. And so we've eliminated the export trigger and said we'll wait for final disposal. Okay, then this is too complicated. I think it's too esoteric. But it's generally most of these are helping the taxpayer. This is an important one. Rollover relief. Generally what happens is when you sell a mineral, you're taxed. And that's the way it should be as a general matter. However, when you have smaller players in the market, many of those smaller players rely on bigger players to refine minerals. So the smaller player will extract the mineral, will resell it to the refiner, and then the refiner will sell the mineral. And what we've done is, the problem is, if you tax it too soon, there's a whole bunch of rules that we have in order to promote beneficiation. And what's happening to those smaller players is they're not beneficiating properly. So they're getting hit with a lot of these anti-avoidance rules. And so in response to that, what we've created is a special rollover regime. And if you extract the mineral and give it to another South African to refine, the refiner could assume the royalty on your behalf. And if they do, they eliminate all the anti-avoidance rules. And this is very important for BEE partners, because a lot of the BEE partners have the ability to extract but not refine, especially the way the DME has broken up things. And the refining operations now are separated from the extraction. So this is designed to assist the BE players not to be impacted negatively by the royalty, and the refiner will assume the royalty instead. Let's move on. I think that's too technical. Let's move on just to some other things. There are two other minerals here. One of the things that we have in the royalty is we charge you based on the kind of mineral you are. And we found that a number of our definitions weren't quite working right. And so with vanadium and ferrochrome, we've adjusted those to make them more in line with commercial reality. But one of the issues that's a bigger issue is on the schedule. The question is how sustainable the schedule is. And what we've done is we tried to create a certain level of beneficiation. But what we're trying to do is reflect the current market dynamics. And that's, we need to adjust that properly to make sure that we're getting the right market correctly. But here what you see in vanadium and ferrochrome is adjustments based on discussions with MinTech and the industry just to make sure they're not overly taxed. And I think that's all there on those things.
Thank you. He says with tongue-in-cheek, I think. Right, voluntary disclosure program. And this is broken up into two aspects. The one is the tax aspect and the other is the exchange control aspect. But essentially, as you will have seen in the budget, we've announced the idea of a voluntary disclosure program. What is that? Well, essentially, SARS has always taken the position that if you come to see us before we find you, we will be more generous about imposing penalties, we'll be more accommodating, and we'll assist you, because you have saved us the trouble of having to find you and go through the whole audit process. Now, that is, as it stands at the moment, a reasonably informal process, And so we understand from taxpayers' representatives that some would like a slightly more formal process. And then also there's the question of those with taxpayers who have both contravened tax legislation and exchange control legislation. What about them? So what's being proposed here is that we help those taxpayers come forward. But there's a very important point, which you'll see on the next slide, is you still have to pay your tax. Okay, we're not walking away from the tax that you have to pay. We're assisting you in some other aspects. And one of the aspects we're going to assist you with is interest. Let me just talk to that second bullet on the background. At the moment, if you don't pay us tax, and you can say, well, the reason I didn't pay the tax was because I had a really good legal argument. SARS has the discretion to waive your interest. And the question then is why? Because interest is really about who had the money. Well, the taxpayer had the money because they didn't pay it. So why should SARS be waiving interest because you had a good legal argument? We will certainly want to waive penalties and additional tax because you had a good legal argument. In other words, you weren't doing something wrong. But the fundamental fact remains, who had the money? The taxpayer, not the fisc. And so there's that conceptual problem that exists in the law as it stands right now. So coming on to the proposal, what we're proposing is that we will run the voluntary disclosure program for a year from the 1st of November. Why the 1st of November? Well, that gives the law a chance to be enacted so that we can get going with it. And there's some criteria for it from the tax perspective, and you'll find out that the exchange control perspective is very similar. And essentially, the most important one is that this is a voluntary disclosure. In other words, if we're busy auditing you right now about a particular aspect, you can't come and tell us about that. Well, we're auditing you. I mean, we know about it. It's an issue. But what we do have is a special rule is, let's assume we are there auditing you about value-added tax, but you've actually done something naughty on your employee's tax. And so what do we do there? Because we're auditing you about a different aspect. And so there's a special rule that covers that, where essentially if it's something we wouldn't have picked up in the ordinary course of the audit, and we agree that it's something that would enhance tax, the administration of the Tax Act, we can let you into the voluntary disclosure program. But there is a cost to it, and I'll get to that in a moment. Sometimes taxpayers don't trust SARS, so an innovation for us, but not for exchange control, is that they can come and talk to us on a no-name basis. So they can say, well, here are the facts, and we can say, well, based on those facts, you would qualify or you would not qualify. The benefit you get once you qualify is that SARS will not pursue additional tax penalties and interest, okay, or a criminal prosecution in respect of your default. And then here's the other bit, which is if you are in the we're in the process of auditing you and we've let you in on this other aspect, we'll only walk away from half the interest because you're already within our grasp space, so to speak. So the benefit of the interest is reduced. A question that often comes up when we deal with these kinds of programs is what's the relationship with the Financial Intelligence Center? We're busy working with them on that because there have been some recent developments in that area internationally. And then as part of this package, since we're giving you a chance to come forward and SARS will forego the interest, is the discretion that I was talking about earlier to waive interest if you had a really good legal argument will be withdrawn once the voluntary disclosure package comes into operation. So this is a one-year opportunity to come forward, tell us about the things that you've done wrong, and we can then assist you to come into the system more fully. Now, as I said, that's just one aspect. The other aspect is the exchange control. And if I may, I'll hand over to my colleagues from exchange control.
Thank you, Chairperson. And the honourable members of the Parliament, I will briefly just give you the background. As the Minister did announce, we are working in line with SARS, but this time SARS will be operating from their premises, and the team that will be focusing on exchange control will be based at the Southern Reserve Bank, so we'll have separate teams. But in short, that is the about the slide that I'll be focusing on. The main objective is to say to SA residents, both individuals and corporates, to say that if you have contravene exchange control sometime in the past, this is an opportunity. It's another opportunity to come forward and regularize your affairs so that you can sleep well. You know, we know that it's always difficult for people to sleep when you are not sure one day somebody will knock at your door. And in terms of the current regime, if we find you out, the penalties range from 20% to 40%. If you want to keep money offshore, we'll penalize you to 40%. If you want to bring money onshore, we'll penalize you 20%. And also have an option to take criminal, you know, procedures against you. So I think this is an opportunity to say to people, this is an opportunity to come forward and regularize your affairs. And what will it mean? It will mean that if you come forward and disclose your authorized assets, then that foreign asset becomes regularized. And what we'll do from our side, we'll grant you what we call a VDP relief. And in terms of that, there will be no further action from our side. What it means is that we won't initiate any actions against you. We won't go to NPA and say that we know Mr. Wu or this company did this. But obviously, we can't stop NPA if they start on their own, but we won't be the one who will initiate the process. I think that's the main issue. Who qualified to be part of this program? All SA residents, as I did mention, that companies and individuals. In the past, we used to say that if you know that we are investigating you, you are not allowed to come. But this time, we say that you can come, but it will be at the discretion of the head of the department. In other words, if you know that there are pending cases against you that were started, you are somehow prohibited to come to the party. But the head of the department or his designated official will have the discretion to say that based on some criteria, he can allow you to be part of the program. Thank you. What do we need for you to come to the program? We need a full disclosure. It must be voluntary. In other words, if you don't come forward, we won't be able to put you to the program. You must come forward and voluntarily. And all the contraventions that must be, the cut-off date is for February 28. In other words, all contributions since 1961, you can bring them forward, but we are saying the cutoff date is February 28. And it must be a full and complete disclosure. And we're also saying that you need to show us to submit proof of the valuation of the asset in a prescribed form. What we'll do, we'll produce the form that will be agreed upon us and SARS. And what would you get if you come forward? There are different options that we can give ourselves. We'll give you 100% relief, or in other words, we may say you don't pay any penalties. That would be the first option. The second option, we can say to yourself that we can give you a credit. In terms of the current regime, where you can take 14 million out of the account of the country, 4 million of the country.
Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair and members. Basically, the program on the relief is that we have four opportunities. You can give 100% relief. In other words, we don't invoke the levy that we want to do, or we can issue you with a voluntary disclosure credit. In other words, that when the current South Africans are allowed to take out 4 million for investment purposes abroad, if you haven't utilized that 4 million, then we'll give you a credit against that 4 million and for any amount under the 4 million, you therefore won't be paying a levy. But if, let's say, you transgressed with a 5 million, take away 4 million, you 1 million left, that million that is over the 4 million, that is the amount that we'll place a levy on. We are aware that there are what we call the loop structures. In other words, there are some structures that have been put in place whereby South Africans own companies offshore, and those companies again own assets back in South Africa, which then leads to the exit of dividends or interest, which just accumulates on the other side that you're taking out more illegal funds. And we will, again, in those cases, we will require them to break that loop structure by dismantling the structure. Or right at the end, if the foreign asset that they've got on the other side is of such a nature that we just impose the levy. We have also, on the next slide, we have, like we did in the previous amnesty process that we had, there are a number of contraventions that are, I don't want to say theoretical in nature, but they are contraventions that have taken place as a result of possible people's ignorance and not having realized that there was a regulation that required them to make a declaration to exchange control. So in these cases, there will be no levies that will be required to be paid, and it just requires these parties, for example, your immigrants, again, in terms of our current rulings, when a new immigrant comes to South Africa, he is required to make a declaration to us, and there are certain one or two little undertakings that he gives to us. As far as foreign inheritances are concerned, that date that you see there, 98/03/17, was the date when we amended the legislation to say that all South Africans from that date onwards are exempted from Regulation 6 and 7, which required you to basically declare your inheritance to us. Foreign income earned prior to 97/07 was another reform of exchange control that said that where you earned income abroad after that date, then you could retain that income abroad and you could subsequently bring it in or take it out without any interference from exchange controls. We also have the unauthorized foreign loans. A lot of people, for whatever reason, when they bring money in from overseas, instead of declaring it as a loan, because of, I should imagine at that time, there was an administrative burden to get approval for it, they bring it in as either gift or under any other category that will allow the money into South Africa. And then when they need to repay it, of course, the South African banks can't repay it because it's a loan. And then they come to us to sort it all out and regularize the position. This is just an opportunity for them to come to us, and we just look at the interest factor that they pay on those loans. As long as it is related to the policy parameters that we've got, then we'll just regularize that as well. The last two are where we will apply levies, and that is, as I mentioned, the loop structure, which you call the 74-26 structures, where people took out money from South Africa, set up a structure offshore, and that in turn came back to South Africa again and then led to the outflow of interest or dividends. Those are, a lot of those are managed or structured through trusts offshore, so we have an ability to deregister those structures, and there is unfortunately going to be a levy payable on that because you did take out, or the persons involved did take out money illegally to set up the structure. The donations to discretionary trust is just also a system where people make donations, we take out money illegally, and basically donate it to people. So if they feel they've done that and want to come clean to us, there's a whole process that we can put in place to sort that out. The levy that we've decided on this time round is not to create a double levy, but to say a straight levy of 10%. In other words, you pay 10% of the value of your assets as of the 28th of February 2010. The money should be brought in from overseas, and what we say is that if you cannot or you have not, maybe you've just got a property there and you don't want to raise funding against it and you've got no other liquid assets on the other side, what we will do then is to penalize them a little bit more by adding another 2% if they pay from local funds. The program, as you see it there, will also run for a year, the same as the tax regime with their voluntary disclosure program, and it
the big difference that I think you need to take note of is that the previous amnesty program that we ran was for individuals only. We've now decided that based on what we've been informed by people who come and talk to us about possible contraventions, is that we need to also offer it to corporate South Africa to see whether they would like to come clean. Again, there are a number of issues which involve the regulations that when they set up the offshore structures, they would have had to use their dividend income in a certain way. There are certain cut-off dates when we change the rules, and hopefully they'll all come forward to us and clarify it. It is obviously possible that there could be elements of over-invoicing, over- and under-invoicing to get money out of the country. So we'd have to look at all of those, and we are in the process of looking at all the possibilities and would obviously welcome public comment from the various bodies like SAICA, the Law Society, and also our authorized dealers that will guide us as to what sort of contraventions are contemplated under this particular program for corporates.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Okay. Chair, I think just to note too that I mean we are aligning these processes between SARS and SARP. It doesn't require legislative changes, the EXCON stuff, through the legislation before you. But I presume there will be some draft circulars that perhaps we should, if we haven't done it already, issue for comment so that people could comment on both because they go together.
Mama, you're 100% right. The only thing that we did look at, and we have got some legal comment on it, is that, yes, there's not an act to be changed, but we may come to government to ask for a amendment to the regulations, purely to give the legal background to the relief that we want to give so that there are no challenges on that. But the main thrust of it will be through circulars, which will be going out. We will also have our draft document on our website by Friday, and it can be accessed on the Reserve Bank's website under the Exchange Control Department. You'll find it there as well.
Thanks, Tom.
The final lap, I'll just finish off here. Two relatively small issues, but one that will have a rider that is perhaps a little bigger and more topical. The one is, SARS for some years now has been offering advance rulings. You can come to us, you can say, I've got a particular kind of transaction I want to into it. How would you treat it for tax purposes? You pay SARS a fee, we then look at the transaction, and then we come back and we give you what's known as a binding ruling. In other words, SARS then has to treat the transaction in that fashion. Okay? You can ignore how we want to treat it and continue to argue your legal point if we're disagreeing with you, but as far as SARS is concerned, then that is how we must treat the transaction. Given that this is something of a service we're providing to taxpayers, what we're saying is, well, since we're giving you certainty with respect to your future transactions, we'd like you to be compliant with respect to your past ones. And so we are looking to say that if you are not compliant with your past transactions, we're not going to give you your advance reading. So if you want an advance reading, pay your tax and make sure your tax returns are up to date. Then there's a reasonably small amendment here. At the moment, a number of people are exempt from provisional tax. And strictly speaking, if you go and look at the law, they're still provisional taxpayers, which means theoretically maybe they should be filling in forms. SARS doesn't actually insist on it, but let's bring the law into line with common sense and say if you're exempt from provisional tax, you're not a provisional taxpayer. Right, this is a slightly bigger one. Recovery of fringe benefit tax from employers. Sometimes an employer does not deduct the correct amount of tax from fringe benefits. Okay, and so what SARS would typically then do is say to the employer, well, you've under-deducted, we'd like you to pay over the under-deduction. Recently, a taxpayer challenged that approach and said, no, what SARS should actually be doing is going to each individual employee and collecting the under-deduction from them. You can understand that that's an interesting problem for SARS because the employer may have 10,000 employees, 100,000 employees, and so we're now having to go to a lot more taxpayers to fix up something that was really the employer's problem. So what we're suggesting here is that... And by the way, the court agreed with that particular taxpayer. So what we're suggesting here is that essentially SARS be placed in a position that we can go to the employer and say, look, you've under-deducted the fringe benefits tax, pay it over to us. And that is what this proposal is about. But talking about fringe benefits tax, people who follow the papers would have noticed there's been a number, or there have been a number of articles about this whole concept of SARS taxing the fringe benefit of the T-shirts people get for the World Cup and so on. No, no such luck. So in any event, now, if you go and look at the fringe benefit tax rules, that T-shirt or actual proper shirt is something, it's an asset. It's something you've been given for free, and just like any other fringe benefit, it should be taxed. Some employers would be prepared to pay that tax on the employee's behalf, some not. Now, that has been raised as a concern and issue, given that the World Cup is something of a once-of-a-lifetime event. And so something we'll be looking at over the next week, and it's not in the bill you're looking at here, is whether there should be a small exemption for employees who receive these kinds of World Cup-related service or good. So all I can say there is watch that space. If we do something, we'll be letting you know about it in the very near future. And then we're getting pretty close to the end. E-filing of transfer duty. Transfer duty is handled by conveyancers who pay it. They're all professionals. At the moment, we have the opportunity to pay on paper through our cash offices, which we're trying to phase out in favor of using the banks. And on the basis that it is typically a business that is dealing with SARS rather than an individual, we're proposing that from the beginning of next year, the use of e-filing for transfer duty becomes compulsory. And then just to finish off, last year Parliament gave SARS the power to amend some of the administrative requirements of the Customs Act to underpin our modernisation agenda. And as part of the framework for it, those rules that we can issue to amend the administrative requirements lapse unless we bring them to Parliament once a year. We've issued one set of rules in 2009. Essentially what happened there was to underpin our e-filing so that people didn't have to give us the documents when they submitted the e-filed clearance. It was something they had to keep themselves and then submit on request within 2 working days. There are a number of ancillary amendments around that. That was something the importers rather liked because it underpinned the whole way they could do business with us electronically rather than doing it through paper. So those rules have been implemented without any controversy, and you will see that there's a new clause in the Taxation Laws Second Amendment Bill which essentially requests that Parliament ratify the rules. And that is it.
Thank you, Chair. I hope this hasn't been death through exhaustion.
Thank you, Momo. Honourable members, Ambrosine, Luyenge. Okay. I think this presentation was clear. There are no questions from members except that of Luyenge and Ambrosine. Honourable members, I'm closing on questions. We only have 2 questions for this presentation, the second part of the presentation. Ambrosine and Luyenge, in that order.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess we need to have a collection point where we can drop all the T-shirts and scarves and all the things we've been receiving before these guys assess an outrageous value of what we receive and tax us for it. On a more serious note, part of the amendments that we will be asked to consider in respect of exchange control and the measures that the Reserve Bank intends to apply to recover some of the assets abroad hinge on an unspoken question which I feel compelled to ask, and I feel compelled to ask it against the background of a few considerations. The unspoken question is, why don't we just have one simple amendment and we abolish the Exchange Control Act. No civilized country of this level of development has it. Even Zambia abolished many years ago. The consideration is that the amendment which we need to make is to avoid South Africa from being bypassed, from becoming the financial center of Southern Africa. You've got Shanghai for the East, New York, London, and it would make sense for Johannesburg to become the financial center. It's not going to happen. It's going to be Gaborone in Botswana. Why? Because there's no exchange control. People don't feel like dealing with all these absurdities. So much so that we have a system in which a law of the state is administered by a private entity, privately owned, which does not operate on the basis of administrative law. Even today, you see them speaking about levies, not fees. They don't speak about authorization. They speak about approval. The entire process in the Reserve Bank has got nothing to do with any administrative process, and any relief of a license or authorization given by any organ of state, which makes it extremely complicated from a legal viewpoint. So we are moving farther and farther in dealing with a problem that becomes more and more complex when the root cause is the Exchange Control Act. Why don't we get rid of it? So I will limit myself to this question because the others I can raise later.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Mine is actually on the voluntary disclosure because the cut-off date already has passed now. Now when we go to the people after the cut-off date, what will be the implications of that? Because people will say there's nothing that we can do now. And is there any consideration maybe of an extension or a particular consideration of disclosures that will come now? Will you be retrospective on this one? And then the other one is around the entertainment and secretarial services. So you seem to be seeking to do away with the secretarial services and entertainment, and what will then be the implications of the spending patterns on a particular on an individual or that company that happens to have administrative support from the secretary, and also entertaining the beneficiaries or its customers at irregular times. Then lastly is around donations. How does the amendment regard the donations made to individuals, the needy, and institutions which are not taxed by government? Say, in as far as the presentation is concerned and the responses, if churches have actually used the monies that they receive for the benefit of the community, so they are not taxed. So now, if you donate to those organizations, how are you going to be maybe regarded as a taxpayer? Because it's a contribution to an organization that is not taxed. Can I therefore be exempted to that particular amount that I've donated to those organizations and the needy? Thank you.
And I hope you have also asked your follow-up question on the previous.
Yes, I've done
that. Okay, thank you. Mom?
Chair, thank you. I think just to answer the first question on exchange control, just to remind members, on page 31 of the budget review, the minister did announce in his budget speech that the Treasury will be releasing a framework document on reforming exchange control legislation. It is legislation that was crafted, before all of us were born, but 1933, so I'm sure everyone's younger than that. That process has been applied. There are areas, though, that one needs to look at, because it's not just a free-for-all. Even in other countries, you often find that have all kinds of controls. It's just that they're not stupid enough to call it exchange control regulation. So we are looking at a more modern approach, and you know, we have removed quite a lot of those provisions over the last few years. There are issues around what we call inward and outward investment that apply, and the other big one, of course, is just that you have limits on individuals and institutions, but we have moved towards a more prudential approach, there are details on page 31 of the budget review. So we do take note of the point that's been made. I think that the voluntary disclosure is just obviously an opportunity for people to come right with their affairs. I have my doubts many members in your constituency would be transgressors. These are often, you have to be very rich and have lots of foreign dealings. But if you have such members in your constituency, sure, you're free to make comments on what the cut-off points are. I know that there are different dates. We will align it more to the extent possible. So when we have the draft circular and the legislation, this process is all about hearing comments, and we are open to tweaking dates if necessary on this issue. I think just with regard to donation, entertainment and donations, you can answer or Keith or France, because there are, again, because we're only dealing with the new issues, there are current provisions that apply. So it is all there in a tax code somewhere, but you need a tax advisor to let you know often. Keith or France?
Thanks, Chair and Mother. Just on the point about the gift of T-shirts and so forth, remember the fringe benefit tax arises when it's an employer-employee relationship. So if my girlfriend gave me a T-shirt, that would not be something that would fall under fringe benefits tax. unless she's my employer, in which case, well...
Is Parliament your employer?
And as to the comment about outrageous values, it tends to be based on market value. So depending on whether the market value is outrageous or not, that would answer that question. On the voluntary disclosure package, there are a couple of different cut-off dates that we're talking about here. There is the one for the applications. Remember, that starts on the 1st of November 2010. So that's still to come. So you've got a year coming from the 1st of November to come clean. There's another cut-off date that says this only applies to offences or defaults that occurred before a particular date. For exchange control, you saw that was the 28th of February 2010. Why do we do that? Simple. Because if you made it open-ended, someone could quickly break the law now and say, oh, okay, but now I'd like to have the voluntary disclosure. So you can't do that. So you've got to have a cut-off date in the past. And that cut-off date was selected because it's roughly aligned to when the budget announcement was made, okay, at the end of the month, February. On donations, there are certain donations that you are able to claim as a deduction for tax purposes. Okay, now those are carefully limited, so that would be things like, best known example is for assistance with the treatment of HIV/AIDS. So there's specified deductions that. So if you make that kind of a deduction to a public benefit organization that does that kind of work, you can get what is known as a Section 18A receipt, which means you are allowed to deduct it for tax purposes. There are more public benefit organizations that are simply exempt. They cannot issue those kinds of receipt, okay? Because government is trying to focus attention on particular issues, and that's where the deductions come in. There's also a bigger conceptual debate about how much you should privatize what government should be doing, which you are essentially doing by pushing it out to PBOs. I mean, but that's a separate conceptual debate. So as far as your donation to a church is concerned, if a church, for example, has set up a particular PBO itself that does HIV/AIDS work, that would be deductible potentially if it meets those requirements. If the church in general just does good work, pays its pastor and all those things, that would typically not be deductible. There are, however, still some concessions. Those donations will not be subject to donations tax. There are concessions with respect to triggering of capital gains if you donate an asset. So there are still some, but you just can't deduct it. Okay, so we try and keep those donations as neutral as possible. And then just on the question about entertainment and secretarial services. At the moment, if you are rendering those kinds of services, you are not allowed to use the turnover tax system. Okay? It's an exclusion. We are taking those two items out of the exclusion. I'll be interested to see if people agree that we should or shouldn't. But we're taking, so essentially what we're doing, it's a bit back to front, is we're saying they are now allowed into the system. Okay, so we're taking them out of the exclusion, so they're not in. We're helping them.
Okay, just to make the point, I think we've used churches or this financing, religious financing. Bear in mind when we talk, we're also talking generally, so it always applies. So if it's a church, it would apply to a temple, it would apply to whatever, that would qualify. So that our legislation is not generally written in any particular denomination.
You're looking for the technical wording, if I remember correctly, it says something along the line, it's a religious organization promoting religious beliefs. And then we even go a little bit further for that. We have another exempt category for people who are simply promoting a belief system, because there are sometimes arguments about whether something's a religion or not quite a religion. So we've covered both.
Just one thing about exchange control. India has a very strong exchange control. And last I checked, they seem to be a civilized people. but there, we do recognize your point. One of the things to go back to about the Gaborone point is that you saw the regional holding company and those incentives. The reason why exchange control is being pulled from all of those is to make sure that we don't lose that competition. So we're actively focusing and making sure exchange control doesn't apply to those areas.
Okay, thank you. Honorable members, no follow-ups. Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Momoniat and your team, thank you very much for that elaborate briefing to this committee. And I hope that, honorable members, it has answered some of the questions that we had prior this meeting. We are cleverer. We can go out to our constituencies and explain the details of the amendments. But if honorable members feel that they still have questions, they are allowed to engage Treasury outside this meeting, and there are other platforms where you can engage Treasury on these matters. The process from now, we will meet as a committee before the end of this week and outline our way forward in relation to public participation in the process. Up until the finalization of the proposed amendments. And I hope we'll meet the stakeholders that are here during that process. And hopefully Mr. Liang will get an opportunity to go out to the people in our localities so that they participate as well in these processes. Hopefully we'll carry our tax advisors in that process to clarify some of the issues. Honorable members, thank you very much, and to the guest, we've come to an end of this meeting.